Disclaimer, the views and opinions you hear on this show are not the opinions of AnimeNewsNetwork.com.
From Los Angeles, I'm Justin Sudeikis.
And I'm Zach Bertie, and we're not going to pretend to have any energy, because although this you're hearing this first, we are doing this after taping and frankly, epic-length interview with one Carl Masek. So that's coming up in a few minutes, but it's also why...
We are completely out of steam.
Yeah. So we're just going to make this real quick. Very briefly, a couple of show notes. First of all, every year, about twice a year, about every 6 months, Rob Bricken has to clean out the Astro Toy closet and sends me a giant box of toys that normally we give them away at anime conventions, but I got a box a little too early in the year this year, and I just don't want it in my apartment. So if you follow me on Twitter, at ANNZach, over the next 3 or 4 days, today is January 13th, so over the next 3 or 4 days, I'm going to be giving them away if you can answer some trivia questions about the show. First response wins. I usually post a photo of the crap you're getting before you answer the question. So it's a fun little game if you want to win some cool anime toys. Some of this stuff is worth, you know, $100 crack. So, you know, check out the Twitter page. You might win something. And other, very briefly, we are looking for a new theme song for our show.
I hate reggae.
Yeah, we know. I'm so tired of hearing about how people don't like reggae. That was picked on a whim, just to throw it out there. I've kind of gotten used to it, but things can change. So if you're a musician or a budding musician or you want to give it a crack at giving us a theme song, we will send you anime and prizes and lavish attention and praise on you. So
we are going to try really hard not to choose just a really lazy acid DJ loop.
Yeah, or a chiptune. Yeah, we want to stay away from chiptunes and DJ loops. But if you're so inclined and would be so kind as to send us what you think might be a cool theme song for this show, please do. We would love to hear it. So anyway, let's get through this shit. What did we watch?
Well, first there were two new shows on Crunchyroll this week that we tried to check out. Do-da-da-da,
mm-hmm.
And the new Space Adventure Cobra.
Right, it is the new season, and a lot of people are asking why we didn't do a season preview. It kind of crept up, and it was the holidays, and didn't really have time to coordinate it. But we will be doing spring, summer, and fall previews this year, just so people know.
Nice.
But so what did you think of Do-da-da-da?
I really liked it. I'm excited about this show. And it's too early to tell whether it's going to be an outright winner, but it's starting off strong. And, what mostly got people's attention is it's by the same director as Bakano and a lot of the same staff.
You can tell, yeah.
Yeah, it looks and feels like it. Heck, the opening is almost identical. Mm. But rather than taking place in a fictitious 1920s New York, it's taking place in modern-day Ikebukuro. Ikebukuro, if you're not familiar with Tokyo, is kind of a seedy area, and it's from the point of view of this one kid from out in the boonies who's going there for school. And it's so far we don't know a lot, but it's clearly a supernatural mystery. I enjoyed it so far because it made me think a lot about the characters. And a show making me think is probably the highest praise I can give a show. I can relate a lot to, you know, an out-of-towner coming in, a young out-of-towner coming into a fast-paced, weird city that's a lot more metropolitan than they're used to. And meeting all the kids that kind of grew up street smart in that area, it's completely not what the stereotype of, you know, anime, you know, Japanese teenagers are like. And it's probably a lot more accurate. Being in New York in my college years, I always noticed that the kids, you know, they seem to have a lot less limitations than out in the suburbs. And sometimes that wasn't a good thing. And they seemed a little tougher, a lot less innocent. I'm looking forward to seeing where they go from here.
Yeah, I didn't have quite a strong reaction to it, mostly because it felt like I was getting such a small sample of what the show was actually about and who these characters were. And most of the time, people say you can't judge an anime by the first episode, and you sort of can get an idea of what you're getting into. And this was such a slight thing, very little ultimately wound up happening in it.
Right.
And so there's an interesting supernatural bent to it, and there's I appreciated the characters. I'm interested in finding out who they are, and I will definitely be watching more of it. But this was one of the first times where I watched the show, and I'm like, well, I need to see more of this, because I really don't have an opinion based on what I've seen so far. Frankly, the ending credits, as they are scrolling down this gigantic cast of endless characters.
We've met three of them.
Yeah, obviously there's a lot more to it. So I'm interested in it. I'm intrigued by it. It seems like it's fresh. Now I'm excited about whatever projects this guy works on. So, yeah, I'll watch more, but I walked away from it with a, okay, next.
I will freely admit that perhaps there's some desperation on my part in trying to find something new that looks promising. But, you know, ultimately it piqued my curiosity, and that's as much as one can ask for in a show at this point.
Yeah.
Without confusing me.
Right. Yeah, that's true. There was nothing, I mean, there's an intrigue and a little bit of mystery to it, but it's not like, what the fuck?
You can follow who is who.
Yeah. Which is important. Yes. So then there was Space Adventure Cobra.
My God. It's sort of like a... If I were to compare this to something American, it would be like if today someone tried to remake Mad Max into a direct-to-video movie.
I don't know. I just, you know, it gets the aesthetic, but that 70s aesthetic only looks good when it's like...
In the 70s.
When it's in the 70s and the animation's really like cheap and janky. Like that's
or at least has a hand-drawn feel.
Yeah, a hand-drawn feel. Feels like it was made, you know, it's a little dirty. There's something dirty about it. This is way too clean. It reminds me of, not quite as much, but it reminds me of Cyborg 009, another sort of attempt at throwback to that sort of 70s style. It was just too clean. The animation was too digital. It was just, just kind of sat there.
Well, more than that, I mean, this was, you know, late 70s, early 80s, this was pulp at its pulpiest.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was cliche and derivative then, but with a grin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 30 years on, it's so cliche and so derivative, and this stuff is so beaten down into the ground by so many shows, American and Japanese, that I find it almost impossible to summon any interest in this whatsoever.
Yeah, no, I just... Not for me. Not for me. I like the occasional throwback, but you got to do it right.
You have to add something new to it, something to give it some sort of relevance in, you know, the 2010s.
Yeah, maybe.
There is nothing relevant about this.
Maybe an ounce of Pomo, give me a little bit of postmodernist humor, you know, maybe just a touch of irony would be nice, you know, something to let me know that... I don't know. Nothing. Yeah. I got nothing. It's
garbage.
No, I'll be watching Dudo, though. That looks pretty good.
Yeah.
So, wow. Let's be finished with the first segment and let people get into this ridiculous, epic interview that we have coming up
this,
next.
This will break every length record we've ever had for a podcast.
Yeah. We should mention it's about 2 hours and 20 minutes. After editing, probably like 2 hours, 2 hours, 10 minutes or so.
There's very little to be cut out.
You're in for a long haul. Let's go ahead and get to that.
All right. Wow. Voltron and the kids of the Voltron Force really saved the day. They always pack a powerful punch against Hagar's evil plans. And Voltron will be back Monday with more amazing adventures. But we've got power to spare. Robotech is next with a new mission for the captain and crew of the Macross on the Voltron Robotech Morning Power Hour.
So we're back, and our guest this week is Carl Masek, who is probably best known as the inventor, we should say, of Robotech, and then went on to work with Akira and Dirty Pair and Vampire Hunter D and a ton of other good stuff back in the VHS era under Streamline Pictures. And a lot more besides, but we'll get to that later. Thank you for joining us.
Well, my pleasure.
So why don't we start out in the early days, before anime really became a thing. You were pretty deep into comics, the comic book market, is that right?
Yes, my career in pop culture began in the early 1970s when I was a instructor at the California State University at Fullerton, and my position was furloughed. And one of my students at the time asked if I wanted a job. And I said, sure. I ended up working for the American Comic Book Company. And later I became a part owner of the company. And we were instrumental at the time in helping launch the specialty retail market in the comic field. Before then, you wouldn't buy your comics directly from Marvel or DC or through any kind of distributors that bought them direct. You would have to go through a a distribution network that was kind of shady, where you would have to return the covers of comics and get credit and do stuff. It was a really weird thing. But we never wanted to do that, but we had to pay a premium for the ability to return the comic books. So, long story short, a bunch of companies from various parts of the country joined together and protested and made enough of a noise that we helped invent the specialty market for comics, which was ultimately important later on in my career. But I worked in that field for about 10 years.
10 years. So that was 79, you said, to about 89?
Well, I started selling comic books earlier, but okay. I actually had the comic book business from around 79 to about 85, 86. I still had it while I was doing Robotech. I still owned comic book stores and had distribution to a variety of other retail outlets in that area for a variety of different products.
I see. How did you first notice some of the stuff coming out of Japan? Was it in that era, or did you know
about it? It was in that era. A lot of the students, I mean, we started this way before there was even, commercial VHS tapes. So at Cal State Fullerton, there were a lot of fans that would record anime off of Mexican TV with these primitive giant reel-to-reel video cassette video tape recorders, and they would meet at Cal State Fullerton and watch these things. And since I was the archivist of a part in the library called the Archive of Popular Culture, a lot of students would come by and show me this stuff. So I was seeing it, and then later on I got invited into this kind of pre-sci-fi anime club called the Cartoon Fantasy Organization, the CFO, where I saw a lot of anime at the time, from like anime pen pals from Japan would send stuff that they would record off television to their friends.
That had to be incredibly expensive.
It was, and it was really funny to see. When video cassettes got more reasonable in the early 80s, is when they started to do it. It was a lot more cheaply, financially less burdensome,
right,
for the fans. And then the Japanese people would concurrently get stuff that the Americans would send over there. They'd send them like Scooby-Doo or whatever cartoons were available here.
Hard to believe there's a market for that anywhere other than America.
Well, people are interested in pop culture, right, wherever. I mean, a lot of Japanese kids like to wear Levi's and, chew bubble gum.
Of course. Was there anything in particular that was being passed around then that caught your eye? Or?
Well, I saw Macross way before. Before I started to deal with Robotech, I saw some of the Miyazaki Lupin shows. I saw a number of the really old ones, Locke, Superman, and a bunch of other. I mean, you're talking, in that period of time, it was relatively primitive stuff. Some of the Tezuka stuff. There was a lot of the Go Nagai cartoons that people were really amused by.
And they still have never since been able to sell here successfully.
Yeah, it's really funny because there's a lot of stuff that it's so ethnocentric that it's hard to actually market a lot of that stuff.
Mm. So during this comic book time, I didn't know this before, but you were actually somewhat involved in the marketing for Star Wars?
Yeah, in the early 70s, while I was the curator of the Archive of Popular Culture at Cal State Fullerton, I was approached by the people at Lucasfilm to become a marketing and promotional coordinator. I used to be the West Coast editor of several magazines, and one of them was called Media Scene. I don't know if you're familiar with that magazine, but it was one of the first pop culture magazines published by a guy named Jim Steranko, who was a comic book artist, really famous comic book artist in the 60s. And he just created his own media venue called Media Scene. And I was the West Coast editor of that for many years. And I wrote a lot of articles, and as such, I got involved with Star Wars way early on in 76, and I did probably the first in-depth article on Star Wars, and then the people at Star Wars liked what I had done, asked me to come help them do marketing and establish a presence with that property at conventions around the country. And there's a guy named Charlie Lippincott, and I worked with him very closely on that, and then subsequently other projects. Alien, the first Alien, Dune. I followed him when Charlie went to Dino De Laurentiis. I went there. When he went to MGM, I went there. I was kind of like his go-to genre guy.
How did that marketing work with the comic book scene? Like, did you make specialty comics in promotion for the film?
Or? Well, we didn't make specialty comics. What we did was we tried to establish branding for the particular properties. And for Star Wars, what we did for branding was we had Howard Chaykin, who was a friend of mine and a comic book artist. He did a poster of the Star Wars characters, and we would give that poster away for free. At the convention, we'd take a table at a convention. It'd be like a science fiction convention with a bunch of typical, you know, booths where guys are selling old comics or old pulps or, you know, the Barbarella, you know, costumes and, you know,
right.
Star Wars, the Star Trek stuff. And so we'd have a booth at these conventions and we'd promote this show saying, here's a new product. And we'd have still photographs and we'd give away a free poster. And we intrigued Marvel enough to do to do a comic book series of Star Wars, and we timed it so that the first three episodes of the issues of the comic book would come out 3 months prior to the release of the film. So episode one, 3 months before issue two, 2 months before issue three at the time of the release, which got people interested in the story and it allowed a kind of an underground marketing to happen. Lippincott had a concept which he developed called the spiral of promotional coordination, called the Lippincott spiral, and what that meant was that way before a movie was to be released, you would target particular groups, and you would start feeding them information. And I realize, of course, this was way before the internet.
Yeah.
So then we target these groups.
This sounds very similar to what's happening today.
Yeah, it is. But the Lippincott spiral is like a classic way of doing this. And as the release date of a particular project got closer, then you would broaden your influential area of marketing. So the scope got broader as the time got shorter. So you would, hopefully word of mouth from these hardcore groups would filter down and make its way into a variety of different sources, so that by the time it was closer to the actual release date, many more people knew about it with a very small amount of advertising.
I see. So how did you get involved with Harmony Gold initially?
Well, I had worked in the entertainment industry for years doing this kind of thing and right. being an editor for magazines. And I actually had worked on the Heavy Metal film in a similar capacity. And one of the deals that the Heavy Metal people wanted was to market the animation art, because I understood this specialty retail market. So I was able to license the animation art for Heavy Metal to sell retail. And at the same time, I also was able to license all of the animation art for the Ralph Bakshi films and a variety of other films. So I had probably in my control about 25 million cells. That's a lot of cells.
Oh, my God.
And so I opened up a retail outlet in Orange. I lived in Anaheim at the time. So in Orange, near Chapman College, I opened up a animation art gallery, which was the first animation art gallery really in the world. It just specialized totally in animation art. And it was contemporary animation art. It wasn't like, oh, I have a cell from Snow White and I've got a cell from Lady and the Tramp. This was like a gajillion cells. Every cell from each scene of the movie that was still in existence. And it was done almost like a shoe store. So people could come in and they could watch the movie on video and say, I want that cell. So I'd have a guy go up into the archive, pull the scene, because we knew what the scenes were. He'd bring it down. The guy could look through the scenes, pick the cell he wanted. And it was unbelievable. It was a great gallery.
What was the average? What were the prices like?
Back then, anywhere from $25 to several hundred dollars, depending on
just like today.
It's kind of like today, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and again, I was one of the first people to market these things, and a lot of the stuff that we did to market them, progression of animation. For example, if there were like a bunch of cells, and there were three or four cells that were like worthless, where the guy had his face away from the camera.
It's like an arm.
Yeah, or no. Right. And then what I'd do is I'd do a progression of these cells. If the guy was walking into a room, I'd do one cell where the arm was there. Then I'd have another window and a mat where you sort of see his body and then his whole head. And you know, so it would have these really cool graphics. And it was a very unique opportunity. And at the same time, the CFO gave me a bunch of Japanese anime cells to sell from Tatsunoko Studios primarily. And the people from Harmony Gold came by one day because they found that it was easier to come and get cells driving 25 minutes to my store in Orange rather than have somebody from Japan send them stuff. They could actually look through picks up and then take it. And one of the guys was at my gallery and I asked him, why do you want these cells? Because it's from some undersea encounter, some movie that, you know, no one would ever know about. And he told me what his company was doing, and I said, what other films do you have that you can distribute? And he started rattling off things, and they mentioned the Macross, and a little bell went off in my head. And I said, well, do you have merchandising rights to that title? And they said, we think so. We don't know. We'll find out. And the guy called me back about an hour later, went back to his office and said, yeah, we do, but we have no plans to put it on the market. And I said, if I can help you get some licenses, can I get some kind of a commission? They said, well, I guess. And so basically that's how the thing started. I met a couple of people and got some marketing and licensing deals for them. And one thing led to another, and they had no interest in marketing this and didn't know what to do with it. And I said, well, let me try to help you market these products.
So how had they been getting... How? Because they had been distributing a bunch of anime as mostly telemovies up to this point.
They were basically company that would take product from Japan and attempt to market it in the United States, but primarily market it overseas. Italy, various countries in Europe, the Middle East, etc., etc. So they had a very good business doing that. And the stuff that they would put in the United States was pretty simple. I think they did one of the Dracula, Toei Dracula movies, I think.
And yes. A few I recently ones. Wrote about that.
Yeah, a few other ones. And, you know, it was a real, you know, simple business. They really were not, there was no desire on their part to really get into this whole genre, because they just, it was a product, they were adapting it, marketing it, and making it available to their clients.
So they really didn't have any designs on the mainstream market in the States.
They had a fellow there in their licensing division that used to work for Western Publishing, which was a big coloring book and, you know, specialty publishing company that would do, like, Big Little Books and stuff like that, and comic books. And he always wanted to try to get something going because he used to work at Mattel, and he wanted to get a toy thing. He could never find the right combination of stuff. And then when he saw me, I had, like, a very similar mindset to him. His name was John Rochnowski. And when he heard what I had to say and how I had got some licenses for Macross before they had any plans on it, he asked me what I really knew that they didn't know. And so I tried to explain to them, in a nutshell, what anime was and how it had an underground following here. And I thought there could be a mainstream application to it.
Right. So you're at Harmony Gold suddenly, and you have, you know, you're able to work with Macross. What could you describe what kind of led you down the road of making it into Robotech?
Well, initially, I had worked at Heavy Metal Magazine for a couple of years as a feature writer, because I had worked on the Heavy Metal movie,
right.
And I had met all those people there. And in the process of it, I knew all the principals at Heavy Metal Magazine. And so I asked them if we could do a per inquiry. If I had some product, could I do a per inquiry ad in their magazine? And they said, sure. So then I went back to Harmony Gold and I said, if we could take one of these anime products and put it out there, I think I can show you what I'm talking about. You know, pictures with 1,000 words kind of thing.
Right.
And so much to my surprise, they allowed me the opportunity to do this. They didn't hire me. I didn't get paid. It was not a paid gig. It was just me trying to prove a point. And so because I knew the specialty retail market, I knew heavy metal, I knew all these things, I got the people together there to dub 3 or 4 episodes of Macross and to tie it together into a feature-length film and release it as Macross. And so we did that. And We changed a couple of that. We anglicized a couple of names. I think Rick Hunter became Rick Yamato. And other than that, it was pretty much, you know, a straightforward adaptation, straightforward in quotes.
For that era.
For that era.
Yeah.
And they hired a guy named Ublia Minucci, who was a friend of Frank Agrama's, to write a Macross theme song.
Frank Agrama being the head of
Harmony Gold. And it was offered for sale through Heavy Metal Magazine at, I think, $30 or $39 a pop, and they sold a nice number of them, you know, 25 to 40,000. I don't remember exactly how many, but they sold well more than they expected to sell at $40 a pop or whatever it was at the time. And that really got their eyes wide open. I said, geez. So subsequently, which I didn't know, is they were in negotiation with Revell Toys, which is actually a model kit company. It was Revell. It was a model kit company. To try to get... Revell wanted to make their company bigger. And so what they wanted to do is they wanted to advertise. They wanted to have a product that they could tag themselves to. And they had gone to Japan a couple of years earlier and had snagged a bunch of model kits when Dogram and a bunch of these Macross and a bunch of other shows were starting to put their product out on the market at the Japanese Toy Fair. So they just came in and they just randomly went through and they just grabbed a bunch of stuff and said, okay, we're going to take this and we're going to call it Robotech. So Revell came up with this name, Robotech. And so they asked me if I could look at these model kits, identify which shows they were in, or any of them shows that Harmony Gold owned, and if so, could I make a show called Robotech based on these shows? And so I said, yes, let me look at them. And turned out that a number of the stuff they had was from Macross. And so I said, well, you've got all this stuff from Macross. They said, great, but we can't use the name Macross. There was some stipulation where they couldn't use the name Macross. I never understood why, never asked. But we want to call it Robotech. And so everybody thought, okay, we'll just call it Robotech because it's an omnibus thing. DC Comics had done a comic book called Robotech Defenders at the time. And we had actually done a comic book concurrently called Macross. And my wife actually drew the comic, and it was put out through Comico. And so all these things were converging all at once. It was almost like a perfect storm of stuff. And eventually I did my research and found out that although Macross was great, it was only 36 episodes, and you couldn't syndicate 36 episodes of a program because the need was at that time to have at least 13 episodes stripped into syndication 5 times a week, which equaled 65 episodes of programming. So I told the guys at Harmony Gold this, and they said, well, what can we do? And I said, well, what other shows do you have? And I went through their library, and I identified there were two other shows that were similar. One was Southern Cross, and the other was Mospita.
Right.
And so I thought, well, maybe I could combine those. And I just sat in a room for about 2 weeks, and I watched all the episodes of all the shows silent. I didn't listen to any dialogue. I didn't listen to any music. I just watched them. I took notes when I saw something visually. There's a creature here. There's a giant here. There's a transformable spaceship here, blah, blah, blah. And as I watched them over and over and over again, I started to see different patterns that I could exploit. And intellectually, well, historically, Macross was first, and then Mospita was second, and then Southern Cross was the most recent show. But in the context of kind of assembling them, I felt it was better served to go from Macross to Southern Cross to Mospita. And I started to come up with a way to merge the shows together and then make something that would be a positive in terms of a story and also allow for syndication. Now, I had an opportunity at that time to take the... There were 84 episodes of these three series combined, and I could have taken the opportunity to cut them all down into 65 episodes to fit the pattern. But instead, I chose to expand and make one extra episode out of material that could be recycled almost like as a flashback episode to make 85 episodes, which would give Harmony Gold the edge, because instead of having 13 weeks of programming, they would have 17 weeks of programming, which would be almost a half a year's worth of programming for a station, and it would be more interesting and a bigger selling point. More episodes for the same price kind of thing. And that's basically how Robotech was evolved.
I'm just to make an observation here. Maybe I'm off, but it sounds like based on the genealogy of this and your history in that sort of space, it was really never, it sounds like it was never really intended to be like a children's franchise. I mean, you were selling the original Macross film in heavy metal, which is not a children's magazine. So was the intent ever to just strip it as like a weekday children's program? I mean, what was the focus in terms of like the demographic?
I never wanted it personally to be a children's program because of the content. And through circumstance, it was certain elements had to be manipulated so that it could be broadcast.
Right.
One of the first broadcast partners was NBC in New York. And NBC, network affiliate,
WNBC,
was going to show it Saturday mornings prior to their typical network feed. So whenever their network feed started at 8 o'clock on Saturday, they were going to show it at 7:30 or something on Saturday morning. So by necessity, we had to conform to the standards and practices of the NBC code, which was relatively strict, which meant that you couldn't show a bullet entering somebody's body. You couldn't show, you could show bleeding, but you couldn't show the cause of the bleeding, that kind of thing. So that's why certain little things had to be nipped out of there, you know, surgically. You couldn't show nudity, you know, you couldn't show things like that. So
today, I don't think you can even show crying on kids' TV.
Yeah. because of that, we had to particularly edit things in a way that was
kid friendly,
or just I guess censor friendly,
right?
Not necessarily kid friendly. The writing of the show was always geared, from my point of view, to be as intellectually honest as possible, given the context of the show that we were making, Robotech. Because my theory was that stuff trickles down, ideas trickle down. You can't really splash up. So if you made a really juvenile show, you couldn't splash up to an older audience. But if you made a relatively adult cartoon, quote unquote, little kids or younger audiences would get something out of it, and on subsequent viewings they would get more, and it would become like something that would be cool because of their older brother or their cousin watched it. Now they're watching it and they're finding interest in it.
Probably a direct cause of the show's popularity, I'm sure.
No doubt.
that was the theory, and the production schedule was brutal. I mean, we had to do this 85 episodes that had to be constructed. I had to help write the plots and then record them in a very short window. I'd say less than 4 months.
Oh, my God.
85 episodes in less than 4 months. So
jeez.
It was really fast. I mean, it was very, very fast. I can remember. And also, what was really cool, one of the guys where we worked, Harmony Gold, had a company that was their dubbing arm called Intersound.
Right. And they just closed like last year, didn't they?
About a year, maybe 2 years ago.
Right.
And Intersound, it was a bunch of really great people there. One guy was I guess you'd call him a nerd before people knew what nerds really were. And
right.
What he did was he tinkered with a Bosch telecine converter. What a telecine is where you take like a 16 millimeter or 35 millimeter film and you run it through this machine and it transfers the film to video. And so he had tinkered with it enough that he could, he put a rheostat on it that I could adjust the speed based on, you know, timing purposes.
Oh, wow.
So that, it was really interesting because what we did was I was able to, there are certain things, just to set the record straight, I didn't really want to edit a lot of stuff, but there were certain things that we had to take out based on criteria. And if you look, we eliminated about 15 seconds per episode. That's about it. Except for when you got to like certain episodes of most speed, or whether it's like a whole episode where they're taking a communal bath or something like that.
Right.
But for the most part, there was not that much cut out of there. But in the process of cutting stuff out, what I could do, I couldn't reanimate things, but what I could do is retime things. And so that's what we did. We literally retimed the entire animation to change the the rhythm of the movement, the rhythm of the talking and everything, so that it seemed more natural to me. And we would just sit there live, and I would change, I would monkey with the rheostat as it would go through the telecine converter. So we would have a direct first generation transfer at the speed and criteria that I wanted to. In the course of doing that, of course, we had to throw out all the music and effects tracks because nothing would jive.
Right, nothing would match anymore.
So, but that was by design because we wanted to change the music anyway because we were interested in making something that was suited for more of an American audience. Although the music was great in Macross and Southern Cross and Mospita, it was contrapuntal. It worked against the actual flow of the emotions, which was a Japanese trait. It was designed contrapuntally. And what I wanted was more traditional, a leitmotif where you would hear there'd be a theme song that would be a battle theme or a hero theme or a love theme, and we could play that in a variety of different ways to indicate character development or movement of action, whatever. So
the John Williams model, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The what?
The John Williams
model. Well, I had worked in these various places, so, you know. Right. The thing is funny, because I'm one of the few anime personalities that actually had a career in the entertainment field, outside of, you know, most of the personalities in the anime field are fans that became entrepreneurial personalities. Where I was actually an entertainment guy who came into it from the back door.
Right. I always like to say that anime is sort of like porn to the rest of the entertainment world, where you can start off in entertainment and dip your toe into that world, that seedy little backwater world a little bit, and then come back out of it and mostly be okay. But if you're starting off in that world, there ain't no way you're getting into the mainstream.
Yeah, it's not good or bad, but it's just it is the way it is. And that was one of the biggest hurdles I had to deal with as I involved myself further and further into anime, is that I came from a background completely different than everybody else. And I saw it in a completely different way than everybody else did.
So Robotech is out after, you know, months and months of all-nighters.
literally.
It's out, and it's a decent-sized hit on TV at the time.
It was a surprisingly successful program, considering the fact that it was booked not on a consistent time slot nationwide. Some places early in the morning, some places late afternoon, some places Sunday at 3 in the morning, but wherever it played, it drew an audience.
And the toys sold pretty well as well.
I wouldn't know. No. I would assume they did, but it wasn't part of my area.
It always seemed like for Robotech, the appeal was the material. It never struck me as being a toy show. Like, Transformers is a toy show.
I agree.
This was more about the content. Like, people were attracted to the programming. It wasn't just kids attracted to toys.
Well, a lot of kids' programming back then were... Literally. I mean, Sunbow Productions was owned by Hasbro's ad agency. Yeah.
I agree with you. And that was the one thing that really made Robotech stand apart from all these other programs, is because I don't know how much you know about the history of syndicated kids programming in the toy business, but prior to He-Man, which was about a year and a half before Robotech, not even that, maybe a year, because everything happened really quickly, they never really had original animation for TV. It was like Bugs Bunny reruns or Woody Woodpecker reruns and stuff like that. But He-Man was the first time that they actually produced a cartoon directly for television in association with a toy company making a toy line. So there was He-Man, then there was like...
thanks to deregulation.
There was like GoBots.
Yeah.
And there were a bunch
thanks,
of...
Reagan.
And there were a bunch of other really weird shows that came on. But relatively quickly in this process was a show called Voltron, which some guy in St. Louis figured out that he could go and buy an animation show, and there were toys, and he had an inspirational idea, and he brought Voltron in. Voltron was a relatively successful show because it had a cool toy line and did stuff. And based on Voltron doing what it did and all these other things, that's why Robotech happened, because of Voltron and He-Man and all these other shows. Where Robotech was different was it didn't have like this built-in toy line for all of the shows. There are some toys for the Macross part, but the Macross toys were built by this company called Takatoku Toys. And Takatoku Toys went belly up just prior to the release of the Robotech franchise, so that you couldn't go to Takatoku and say, oh, let's do a license deal. You produce your toys and bring them in. Bandai ended up picking up some of the molds from Takatoku, and the one that was really the great one was the Veritech Fighter, which was the cool transformable thing, and they put it into their Transformers line to get it away from the Robotech line. I mean, there was really a lot of backstabbing. It was really a crazy business back then, but it was all geared to sell toys, whereas Robotech wasn't geared to sell toys. It was geared initially to be a calling card for Revell to sell model kits, but you're never going to sell enough model kits to support a television show. But it was going to be a cool calling card for Revell to say, hey, we got a TV series based on a product line that we have.
So. I see. Revell's still around today, aren't they?
I think so. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think they are. Yeah.
So Robotech's a success. What then?
We were asked by the syndication department to produce a sequel, which we started and developed Robotech to the Sentinels, in which we were going to do 85 episodes of new animation based on the stories that we had developed in Robotech. And that was going to be a joint venture between Harmony Gold and Matchbox Toys, because Matchbox wanted to have product line extension for their toy business that they thought Robotech would be a key part of. And one thing led to another, and things got a little dicey. All the episodes were written, characters were preliminarily designed on a variety of levels, and animation had been started. But for one reason or another, Matchbox decided that the project was either too rich for them, or they didn't want to deal with it, or for whatever reason, they pulled the plug. Mm-hmm. And the Sentinels, although it was sold to 65% of all American households, collapsed. And I was able to pull together a feature-length version of the animation that had been produced at the time and was released subsequently to television and also on home video. And then at Harmony Gold, we continued to produce different projects for marketing, trying to get a toy company interested in an animation project. I did that for about a year, and then eventually I stopped and went over to Deke, and I worked at Deke for a couple of years, where I developed TV shows like Cops for Hasbro and worked on a variety of other projects.
Cops wasn't that an acronym for something?
COPS. It was
all I can think of is the Fox show.
No, this was a cool show based on a Hasbro toy line where they had police versus criminals. I wrote maybe 25 episodes of that original animation and was the story editor. I was the first person to have a black female president of the United States and stuff like that. I really did some very, very, very wild stuff. And during that period, I met John Crisfalusi, who had similar attitude about things. And he left, and he went over to Courier Films. I left. I went over to Courier Films. I worked on Courier Films for a while. Developed a property with Courier Films called Rail Runners, which ultimately we developed and sold to Harmony Gold, and then sold it to Netter, who was doing Babylon 5 at the time. Never got produced. And then Crisfalusi and I worked together early on and developed a business which eventually became Spumco, and we sold Ren and Stimpy to Nickelodeon. And then during that period of time, I developed Streamline Pictures with Jerry Beck.
Yeah, could you just talk a little more about that era? This is interesting to me. We had this conversation earlier. You were actually involved in selling Ren and Stimpy to Nickelodeon. How did that happen?
Well, John Crisfalusi is a very unique talent. And he saw me, someone that was kind of like a business mind. And he liked the fact that I understood animation enough that it wasn't a mystery to me, but that I was not an artist, so I wouldn't be someone that would try to infuse my ideas onto things, because I'm not an artist. And so we worked together, and we developed a business. And during that time, we developed a bunch of different properties, and I got a bunch of work for us. We had a cool group of animators, Jim Smith and Naylor and Crisfalusi and a bunch of guys, and we were all working out of an office next door to Streamline Pictures. So we were all kind of working together, distributing animation to theaters and making pitches for cartoons and stuff. And we had heard through the grapevine that Nickelodeon was going to be in Los Angeles looking to scope out the talent. And we weren't really a legitimate animation entity. We weren't doing commercials or anything. But Chris Faluci was so talented that I was able to contact the people at Nickelodeon, this woman in Vanessa Coffey, who was in town, and I said, you've got to see us. We're, you know, let's just give us 20 minutes, and then if you don't like us, then see you later. So the last day that she was in town, she said, look, I'm leaving for New York in about 2 hours. Come in, give me 15 minutes of your best stuff, and then that'll be that. So we stayed up all night, and we developed this couple of kids' programs, one called Jimmy the Retarded Boy, which was really unbelievable, and the other one was called Your Gang, which was kind of like Our Gang, but with the Chris Faluci slant. It was really irreverent. And we pitched these two shows to her, and Chris Faluci is he's a force of nature when he does these things, because he's possessed, and he just runs around and does voices and acts and just becomes like a human cartoon. It was an unbelievable experience. And Vanessa Coffey realized immediately that Chris Faluci was talented, and called New York up and told them that she was bringing two crazy people back to visit Nickelodeon. And so we took our show on the road, went to New York, and we did the pitch to the Nickelodeon executives, and they went crazy, and they offered us they offered to buy both of our projects, Jimmy the Retarded Boy. But they didn't want Your Gang, because Klasky Csupo had just done the Rugrats, and they were going to take the Rugrats from them, so they wanted something different. And one of the executives at Nickelodeon saw these pets that were the pets of the people in Your Gang, and they said, can you make a show on those pets? And they were Ren and Stimpy. And of course John said, yeah, we can do that, no problem. So they offered us this deal, and we walked into Central Park for about an hour to try to figure it out. And John, who was invested in Jimmy the Retarded Boy, didn't want to sell that to Nickelodeon at the time, but since he had no investment in Ren and Stimpy, he thought this would be a great way to start a studio. We agreed to do that, and we went back and we said, we'll sell you Ren and Stimpy, we're not going to sell you Jimmy the Retarded Boy. And that's how the Spumco, which is the name of the company, got started. And then immediately after that, I had the opportunity to either stay at Spumco and just become like an executive, or be more involved in the creative process of the bringing over Japanese animation into the United States with Streamline. And I decided that Chris Faluci was set up pretty well on his own to do what he needed to do. He didn't really need me. So I just bounced over to do Streamline instead and let the guys off on their own.
Now, Streamline, we kind of brushed over this, but how did that start? How did that whole project start?
Jerry Beck, who was an animation historian and a employee of a variety of film companies, came up to me and asked me one day, because we had similar interests in vintage cartoons and stuff. He was a friend of Chris Faluci's. He said, what do you think about the possibility of marketing theatrical animation in the United States? And I said, I think it's good. I think it's unique, and there's a lot of really cool stuff around. He said, do you think you have access to some of the stuff? I said, I don't know, probably. And so we decided to create a business and work together and see if we could actually do something. And the first film we got to work on was Laputa, which is a Miyazaki film. And we ended up contacting the distribution company, which was Tokuma Shoten, and told them that we could put their film into theaters if they paid us money to do it. So it was kind of like a work for hire, that they would pay us, we would put the film in the theaters, and that was it. And we were given a 6-month window, I think, or a 4-month window to do something. And we put it into about 60 theaters in 4 months. They were shocked, and they made money, so they were thrilled. And we didn't dub it. Streamline didn't dub it. And I told the people at Tokuma Shoten that I thought the dubbing was marginal on Laputa, and I thought that it could be better if they had their product could be better if they had a better dubbing. So
So that was dubbed by Tokuma Shoten?
No, it was dubbed by, it was paid for by Tokuma Shoten, but they just picked some company out in the middle of Hollywood to do it. They just phone book picked a guy and said, here, do this.
Okay, I always thought that was one of your dubs.
No, Streamline didn't dub Laputa at all. We wouldn't have. I mean, I would never. I mean, that. See, to me, there's a certain element of class that you can bring to a project, and Laputa is a very classy film, so it required a classy dub, and the dub that was given to that particular film was
a little clumsy.
Adequate, but clumsy. Yeah, okay. I didn't like it at all. They could have had continental accents on the guys that were continental. They could have done a variety of things instead of, you know, adding like, oh, stupid voices like that, you know, talk like this. And it's not something that I appreciated intellectually and also aesthetically. So, to make a long story short, I said, the next time you want to do something, let us dub it. And so they gave us an opportunity to do that with My Neighbor Totoro, which they hired us to dub. And we dubbed that, and it was a very successful dub. And they didn't want us to distribute it because they thought they could get a better distributor, so they hired Troma to distribute it. And Troma distributed it theatrically for a while, and then Troma eventually... moved out of the way when Fox Home Video picked up the video distribution rights to it. And it was a very successful thing. Based on the success of that, they hired us to dub Kiki's Delivery Service. In the meantime, we still wanted to get more films for Streamline. And because we had done Laputa, we were able to be taken seriously by the Japanese film companies. And one of my friends was an agent for Kodansha, was one of the principals in the Akira committee trying to get Akira out into the marketplace. And so they being Kodansha, the Akira committee, dubbed a version of Akira themselves in Los Angeles using all of the quote-unquote streamlined stock actors that were around at the time. And they marketed it to all the major studios. Nobody bit. So again, Streamline comes in at the very end of the process and says that we'll be happy to distribute this film, but we need you to pay us money to do it. And we gave them a budget, and we said, we'll give you all the money that is earned from this film up to a particular point, and once the box office reaches that point, then we'll split the money at a particular percentage. And the Kodansha people thought, what a great deal this is. We have to pay this money. But so they did, and Akira was very successful, competitive with most major international films being distributed at the time, and even comparable to some of the traditional films being shown. So we did very well with Akira, and that established Streamline as an entity in the process of doing that. We ended up picking up Fist of the North Star, Lensman, Robot Carnival, Wicked City, a variety of high quality, which I thought high quality films at the time, that would make interesting theatrical exploitation. And they were all theatrically exploited, and they all were successful. 14 theatrical releases, all of them making money.
Wow. What kind of numbers were these releases doing?
Back then, one print, one screen, $35,000 a weekend, which is pretty good.
That's still good.
That's still yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Yeah.
So you know,
we should be so lucky today.
it was remarkable. I mean, the industry was different back then too, because there were more independent theaters. There was a network of independent theaters. Jerry Beck, because of his experience as a theatrical booker working for UA, had a bunch of contacts, and he also worked for Landmark, and he had all these contacts. So we were able to manipulate Jerry's contacts and the fact that we had all these properties. And then utilizing the Lippincott Spiral, we could go back into people like Marvel, who had the animation, the comic book rights to Akira, and get them to put in the back of every comic book saying that if you live in, you know, Dayton, Ohio, Akira's going to play there March 14th or whatever. And so we had a synergy of, again, pre-internet, right, doing this in a way that was, but we never had home video rights. So then the next hurdle was to try to get home video rights for Akira. I mean, this is an ongoing process where we're always like, you know, they tried everybody, but when it failed, then they say, okay, go ahead and do it. You know? And that's how Streamline just built a reputation of the people that would get it done and make money for people. And so we were very successful in all of the properties that we exploited at the time.
Now, Streamline was kind of unique in that they were, it was kind of the first company to really try to get this stuff out into what I would consider mainstream, you know, for anime at least, and not really jack around too much with the story and really just, and not edit at all, really.
When it was Streamline, the philosophical point of view at Streamline was, what would the original creator do if he was doing it in English? To try to open it up to a Western market. That was it. And sometimes we would change a word here and there, but not much that it would be like, oh, this guy's a doctor and we turned him into a trash man or something. And, you know, we didn't do a complete, you know, repurposing of the storytelling. We tried to market it for a Western audience, you know, with particular language choices and things like that. I remember one show we did, which was called The Castle of Cagliostro, and there's a character called Goemon, that's the samurai.
Right.
And he has a running gag in this TV series. It was like this long, ongoing series, 100 and some 200 episodes, where he was interested in honor. So he didn't want to have his sword dishonor him in any way. And there's a scene where he does some action which results in these people losing their clothes in this thing. And so we came up with a line to this is a quip to deal with this particular situation, rather than try to explain what this weird, you know, intellectual line would be for people that were really into it, because that was going to be the first time anyone in the West had seen Lupin the Third. And because since no one had seen him, it was irrelevant to try to get so technical with the translation. And I got like crucified for that particular line. One line of dialogue in a thing.
Oh, sorry.
But it actually won an award as the best dubbed film of the year whenever it was released.
So. Yeah, I mean, people tend to not look at that stuff in context, and you're providing this context now. But I think the people who nowadays complain about Streamline does, and frankly, like,
in there aren't this, very in many this, people nowadays.
Not anymore. Now they're considered gems. Like, a lot of people really express a love for those dubs because it's what got them into Japanese animation in the first place. So it's gone from being, it went through a period where people were complaining about the inaccuracy or whatever. Now I think it's come back around, full circle. So now there's a big group of people that just appreciate it and just.
Well, it's funny, you know, because it was a tricky thing at the time, because when we did it, my theory was that all cartoons are dubbed. So they're all dubbed. So why subtitle them, especially when you have a cartoon that is so pretty to look at anyway, or it could be gruesome, but it's still an attractive medium to look at. So why sully it with, you know, words that you'd have to continue, you would be reading the words and not really watching the show. And since they're all dubbed anyway, dub it, localize it for your audience. And that was basically the guiding principle of Streamline, was localization, so that it would get to the broadest mass audience. And I don't think that since we stopped doing it, people have taken that philosophy to heart and understood what it was. And you can see that the sales of anime has bottlenecked and probably even diminished, you know, except on certain, you know, fluky titles. It's not been, you know, it hasn't been a progressive growth. It's been like a stagnant growth, and maybe even a decline on certain titles.
Maybe. Try you know, hitting the dirt and bouncing a few times.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to be kind.
That's not what we do on this show.
No, we are not kind people.
But I mean, a good example of that is that Akira dub, which people loved. And I love that dub. And when the new one came out, yeah, technically, like, it was a little easier to understand what was going on in the film. But everybody said, where is the original? Like, everybody right, wants
they
that
wanted
Streamline.
The nostalgia effect.
Yeah, it's a nostalgic thing now.
Yeah, but see, and even Streamline didn't even dub that. And see, I was accused of dubbing that thing. We didn't. But the Streamline actors did it. But it was a really funny deal. The Akira committee only wanted to work with someone that had been recognized for excellence by the Motion Picture Producers Association, so they wanted to get someone that had been nominated for an Academy Award or had won an Academy Award to work on this particular film.
Okay.
And they found some guy, my friend found a guy that was a guy nominated for writing a documentary film or something, that he had gotten some recognition by the industry. Mm-hmm. And because of that, he was able to secure that job. And if you watch that Streamline demo, if you ever get a chance to see it, towards the end when Kai, the chick is wearing Kaneda's jacket. Mm-hmm. The actor that plays Kaneda is voicing Kai's part because the director said the guy with the jacket is the girl. And I mean, if you watch it, you'll see this, and it's one of those things that just it drove me up the wall every time I saw it, because it just was it could have been a very easy thing, and that annoyed me, and I don't get annoyed that often by things, because that was a big goof. But be that as it may.
When you released these things, obviously, you know, marketing them, there was a lot of money and time spent in trying to find an audience for this. And at the time, it was mostly entirely foreign to Americans what this stuff was. Who did you target? Who did you see as the audience for this stuff?
Well, initially, because I had known the comic book market fairly well, I targeted the comic book specialty retail market. And what I did was, we were prohibited from distributing Akira into video stores initially. Prohibited. So in order to go around that, I knew that there were about 3,500 comic book shops and specialty retail shops just starting. Back then, it was a more popular thing. You could not find one on every corner. It wasn't like Starbucks, but there was at least every major city had a comic book shop,
right,
of one sort or another. And those comic book shops, if they were smart, were selling role-playing games, and they were selling toys or whatever they could get their hands on. So I went to these distribution conferences, and I would speak to the store owners directly and say, would you like to have video that is not available in the video stores that will allow you to draw an audience? And that was overwhelmingly accepted. And because of Akira and the Marvel comic Akira, we were able to get Akira and the Akira production report and all these weird things into comic book, especially retail stores, and the sales were remarkable. All the other Streamline titles, we could sell it wherever we wanted to, but Akira was like this forbidden fruit to sell at the, you know, video stores. And eventually, Kodansha recanted and allowed us the opportunity to do that. And I had a distribution company called Tapeworm, and they were like a small distribution venue.
I remember Tapeworm, and I just used to laugh really hard whenever I saw it, because, like, who in their right mind would call their company Tapeworm?
I know. But they were very, very good. And, see, again, I didn't come out of the retailing, the distribution of video market like somebody like O'Donnell and these other people did. And I wasn't a fanboy. I was just a guy that I figured, okay, I have a product and I'm going to sell it. And we offered it at a fairly reasonable price. And I said, no returns. Okay? No returns.
Wow. That would never, ever fly today.
Well, because people don't get it. They don't get it. And I said, if it's defective, I'll replace it. But you can't return it. You buy it, it's yours. Because I have to pay the Japanese.
Right.
And so my royalty statements were clean. They were easy. Tapeworm paid. They were paying me, you know, $800,000 a month, you know, or more. I made this little company very successful with selling 20 or 30 different anime titles at the time. Eventually, things moved along and I was selling to other places, but at the outset, the Tapeworm was really a key component in the exploitation of the video properties into traditional video venues. I also made deals with people which no one even realized. I was the first guy to put anime on satellite television. I put anime on satellite TV called Network One. It was like the first satellite thing, and I was getting it out to people in, like, you know, Dust Bowl, you know, Nebraska or wherever else they were showing these things. And
I remember seeing Wicked City on Action Pay-Per-View.
Yeah. And I put all these things out. And I got stuff on TV. I got stuff on Turner. I got stuff on the Sci-Fi Channel. And I was really promoting this stuff. And I, you know, it was a very successful operation. Got stuff on MTV. And, you know, the whole goal was to expose people to anime. And, you know, in a way that made sense, not in a way that was pretentious or, trying to keep things, you know, so authentic as to be, you know, obtuse to a general audience. I was trying to make it less obtuse. And the work was interesting. It was fun.
You know, around the same time, there's a bunch of competitors starting up. You got Central Park Media coming up. You have Animego. ADV starts around this time as well. U.S. Renditions. That did you feel any... These guys were all releasing subtitled stuff, subtitled VHS, and then occasionally dipping their toe into dubs as they got bigger.
Years later.
Did you feel... I mean, I'm sure the fan community was just, you know, completely up your ass about not releasing subtitled VHS.
I really didn't care. Yeah. And I'm not to be like...
A sound philosophy.
But I'm not to be... You know, smart ass about it. My goal is if I put it out subtitled, my theory was I would be preaching to the converted, you know, because they already know what it is. And so why that to me was, that was the first concept in my head of fan service. Why do that? Because those people like it and they've probably already seen it through a bootleg copy, which some guy subtitled with some cheesy computer program that they had themselves. So they already had that. So why do I need to do that? My goal was to sell it to people outside of that demographic, outside of that, and to exploit these things. And I'm using the word exploit in a good way.
Right.
Exploit these titles to a broader audience. My titles sold many more times percentage-wise than these other titles. There's no comparison. I mean, there's literally no comparison. Unless Central Park Media got like some Orotsuka Doji or some, you know, thing that was like so over the top that, you know, people just, you know, for a freak factor would watch it, you know.
Right.
But I tried to pick, and I also tried to pick what I considered evergreens, titles that I thought would be able to be played again and again and again. Perfect for home video rental stores, and also perfect for... you know, repeat viewing. Yeah.
He also mostly stayed away from series.
I tried to because I didn't want to exploit the series. I did a couple of them, and I came up with a concept at the time called video comics, where I put one episode of a show on a video cassette and sell it for like $9 retail. So the theory was he'd do it like a comic book, but I didn't want to put them all out. I could have put them all out. I did one with Zillion, and I did one with Nadia. And I could have put them all out, but by putting them all out, I would have destroyed any television marketing potential that the series had, because no broadcast entity would broadcast a show that has already been marketed on home video. And I was taking a chance by even putting out 5 or 10 or whatever. So I was very hesitant about dealing with series, because I felt that initially to market a series to home video it destroys the ultimate viability of that particular program. And, you know, as you can see today, when everybody that distributes anime puts out series ad infinitum without having the infrastructure of a television broadcast and a merchandising campaign, it eats away at the infrastructure and ultimately collapses the infrastructure. So my theory was correct. Unfortunately, I was, you know, at the beginning, and Streamline was self-funded. We never took a loan. So, I mean, I could only get what I could get based on the money I had at the time to pay advances and royalties.
So you had all these really big releases that every blockbuster in the country had them. Kids were eating them up. They're on Sci-Fi. And then the catalog gets sold to Orion.
I have a lawyer, and my lawyer, at a corporation, and my lawyer, we have our annual meeting. He says, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, you know, I really don't want to distribute other people's stuff. I want to make my own stuff. Yeah, you know, it's really, I was a writer and a filmmaker anyway. That's what I started off to do. So they said, well, what if we can find you a venue to distribute your stuff and then give you an opportunity to go out and make cartoons? And I said, that sounds like a great idea. So we located Orion, which was coming out of bankruptcy, and they couldn't make new films because they didn't have access to the income that was made from the money that was in their catalog. But if they got new catalog material, they could exploit that new catalog material. And so I came in with a catalog of 80 products, which they could market, and they were thrilled because they saw the trends and they saw how my films were really doing well. So they picked up the Streamline catalog, which was in theory going to free me up to then take my business to go and make new animation. So we did that. And in the process of doing it, they made the fatal error of thinking that if Streamline's product sold great at $29, they'd sell even better at $19. And I thought that was a mistake because it was a niche product, and the niche product could continue to sell $29 all along. make a long story short, they put it in at $19.95, and it didn't sell more. It actually sold less. I made more money selling my products at $29.95 per tape for a feature-length film than they were doing selling them at $19.95 at the time, because they didn't know how to market them. They didn't their salespeople. They had a network of salespeople. They didn't really understand them. They said, "Hey, we got this cool stuff," and blah blah blah. Here it is. And so the sales were exploited to a lot of different smaller venues that I didn't deal with, but it didn't really increase the ultimate income for the Japanese or for Streamline. Subsequently, we started not to try to acquire products. They didn't really see it, because what was happening, this is another thing which was a net result of all these guys, the value for the royalty or the advance against royalties for properties kept increasing as more and more people got into the market, and they were amateurs and they didn't really understand how to bid on things. So they would say, okay, let's say it cost me $25,000 to get Wicked City. I'm just giving you an example. The next Wicked City 2, if there was one, because I was successful and there were a bunch of other guys wanting to get it, it might have increased to $50,000 or more or more or more. So now what was a reasonable price to acquire foreign distribution rights to a product had become unreasonable. And the unreasonable nature of it caused, I think, again, an overweighted business profile, where you had to feed this monster, and you had to continually put crap out in order to have a cash flow to pay the cost of the money that you're expending to get the rights to the product that you were dealing with in the first place. It was,
boy, did we see that pattern.
Yeah.
am I pretty correct? In
yep.
Dead on.
Yeah. That's so, exactly what happened. Yep.
So it's an unfortunate situation, because amateurs got involved in something that they knew nothing about. And because they were willing to pay, because they thought, oh, geez, if I was going to produce animation, it would cost me, you know, $150,000 a half hour, but if I buy it for $50,000, I'm saving 2/3 of my cost. Yeah, but if you could buy it for $5,000 an episode, which is what it should be, because you're just merely, you have no rights. You know, you don't have any rights. You're just marketing. You're exploring something for somebody else. It's a distribution deal, a licensing arrangement. So, but anyway, that screwed up the industry badly, I think. When I felt you could make animation cheaper than acquiring it.
Wow. So what was, as the catalog started to flame out and you were kind of, you know, walking away in the shadows of it, you started doing some pretty interesting original animation projects yourself. Could you tell us a little bit about
that? Yeah, I mean, the first thing I did was, at the point in time that Orion was involved, I did two things. I created a 3D-ish company, not 3D like 3D comics, but a toy design and manufacturing company, where I made model kits, very high-end model kits, resin kits, and I made toys for various companies like Jack's Toys or a few other companies. We did the Independence Day toys. We designed them. We did the toys for the World Wrestling Federation. We made all these cool toys for like Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, and junk like that. So we were doing toys. We actually made miniatures for movies. We did a whole bunch of, we had a whole miniature department where we would make miniature sets and blow them up for movies and stuff like that. And in the process, I sold Rail Runners back to Harmony Gold and Netter, and I got the rights to do a new heavy metal movie, which eventually turned into this project called Heavy Metal 2000, but it was basically an adaptation of a comic book written by Kevin Eastman called, we called it Fact 2, but I think it was called, I can't remember what the name of the original comic book was called, but whatever that comic book was, we had to develop it into a new project for distribution called Heavy Metal Fact 2, which we sold to Columbia Pictures, and eventually I had to pull out of that for a variety of personal reasons, but that movie, I never liked the end result of that movie, but it was an interesting project. And then ADV contacted me and wanted me to work for them and develop an animation studio for them to create original animation. So I went to work for them.
So you actually moved to Houston. Let's talk about that. ADV Films. You get there pretty much specifically for one project at the beginning, right?
Mm-hmm. Lady Death. They got the rights to do Lady Death, and they wanted to see if I could write a screenplay for Lady Death, and they hired me to do that, and then to produce it, and to basically create a a business model to produce additional animation projects up to 5 a year. So I thought that'd be great.
You'd known John Ledford from years and years earlier.
Oh, yeah, I knew him from my comic book days. I knew him as a buyer of comic books from me when I was going around the country selling comic books. So I watched him grow up, and I actually helped him redefine what ADV was going to be early on in the genesis of their company. I gave him some pointers, which he took to heart, and eventually that became the core of what ADV was, like the monster accumulator of anime.
The Microsoft of anime.
Yes.
As they referred to themselves as.
But the goal at ADV was to create original animation. And so once I started doing that, I really didn't want to go there to do dubbing, because there was a hierarchy at ADV which was really fan-tolerant or fan-oriented. And I was like, it was like, you know, me walking the gauntlet every time I'd go to my office, because, you know, the people didn't really like me that much there because of what I represented. And I was like, you know, the anti-fan movement.
Ugh.
So, wow, that sounds horrendous.
That sounds really irritating.
It was bizarre. It was a bizarre situation. And I could never get off that, the stigma of what it was I had done in the past. No one really understood me there, except Ledford. He kind of understood what I was about. So
nobody made an attempt to figure you out?
And no. Like, when I got there, the funniest thing was when I got there and they eventually decided to have me start doing ADR, they didn't even know how to actually do ADR.
We heard the dubs.
Yeah. No, well, beyond the dubs, there's a process of which, standard industry process, in which you take an actor, you put them in a recording booth, and they watch the animation, and then you cue them as to when they're supposed to talk. And the cueing is a series of progressive tones, beep, 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 and on the, where the fourth beep would be, that's when you're supposed to talk. So you get this rhythm, it's beep, 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 talk. Well, they didn't know what the beeps were. So what they would do at ADV is
that's really basic stuff.
Oh, it's totally basic. So what they would do at ADV is they would have the guys watch the Japanese animation, and they would listen to the Japanese actor, and then they would roll back and they would rerun it, and then whenever the actor would just jump in and just talk, he would just talk, and then the mixer would then take the dialogue if the director liked it, and he would manipulate the dialogue in the session to kind of match the mouth, sort of, maybe starting when the mouth opened, and if it was going to close, where it closed, they would like take out all this air in between the words and kind of do that. And I said, well, that's kind of weird. But they also didn't know how to write ADR to sync labials and plosive, mouth movements. It's like a mystery. Matt Greenfield would write these fairly authentic, interpretations of these things, but they never really had a sense of directorial panache. I mean, they never really, there wasn't like a sense of there's a mind behind it, you know, manipulating these people to get them to do something in a particular way. It was the actors would just act, and they were all relatively good actors, to a certain standard. And they would just let them, you know, perform and then try to manipulate the performances. And when I came in, I was like the who the hell is this guy? The Frankenstein of dubbing. And I came in and brought the beeps in, brought in really, you know, well-written scripts that were timed properly. And so I could produce faster results. And it was shocking to the actors there. And when the actors finally learned the system, they were then able to go to other places like Funimation and do stuff that was with beeps.
Done properly. Yeah.
So a lot of the people were thrilled that I taught them how to do this, or else they would never have gotten to the point where they could do this. Because it was almost reverse engineered dubbing. I don't know how to explain it. But what was funny was whenever they gave me an assignment, they always gave me like the worst possible program to dub.
I noticed
because
that.
Of who I was. I mean, they had all these really great shows, and they would give them to these really bizarre personalities to do, but that somebody like me, if they would take my criteria and my, you know, credentials and put that with a product, they could have marketed it better. But they gave me these really cheesy products to do because They didn't give a shit. Pardon my language. They didn't care.
Yeah, we swear all the time.
Yeah. They just didn't care what I did, whatever it was.
So is that how you wound up on Aura Battler Dunbane?
No, actually, I wanted Aura Battler Dunbane.
Okay.
Because
our fans will be happy.
Yeah.
No, I actually wanted that one because, to me, that was like when I was doing Robotech Macross at the time, the yin and yang of Japanese animation at the time, Robotech was one and Aura Battler Dunbane was the other, because they were like, you know, brilliantly conceived projects, but from different, you know, worlds. One was a tech world, one was a fantasy world, and they were both really interesting. And I had even gotten Harmony Gold interested in Aura Battler Dunbane back in the early 80s. Mm. And it had never been done. And to my surprise, no one had ever acquired it. And Ledford just ended up getting it at some point in time. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, please let me dub this thing. It's something I've always wanted to do. So they allowed me to do it. And it's funny because when I did it, a lot of the fans, the hardcore fans, were really just waiting to try to criticize it. And some of the stuff they criticized was really funny because I did research on what Tomino was doing with the storytelling. And he was really into like Orkney and fairy tales and all this kind of stuff. And I looked up the research, and there was a character, there was a class of creatures in there called in the Japanese Mifurario, okay? But if you look at what that is, they were trying to say Fiorine, because there's a word in Orkney and also in this, you know, off-brand of English where Fiorine meant the fairy people. So that's what these people were. So rather than call them the Mifurario, which was a hard thing to say, he just called them the Fiorine, because that's what they are. And, oh, there's Masek doing his own thing again, changing everything around. But it's not like I'm doing it on my own. I'm researching this stuff to try to, you know, figure out what the guy wanted to say. And, you know, it's like, you know, they're never given an opportunity to express these types of things. It just drove me insane. And then the voice actors there, I wanted each of the tribes to have a different basic accent criteria based on the, you know, the British Isles as a model. So Scottish on some, Irish on some, blah blah blah. Some actors were better than others at portraying these particular.
I imagine that's hard to cast in Houston.
Yeah,
it was not easy, but there are some guys that were great. John Swayze, one of the great voice actors there, was great. There's a number. Jason Douglas is really good. Black, her name, I think his name was Colleen Black, was really good. Jay Hickman was wonderful. He was the star of it. And all the people were really good. Vic Mignogna was in it. He was a funny guy. He played this really esoteric character. And it was one of the first times he really got like a major starring role. And he was really feeling his oats and was doing all sorts of wacky stuff. So I would just let him do it the way he wanted to, like he was doing with everybody else. And then I said, okay, fine, now let's do it my way. And I'd show him how I wanted it to be done in a way that would make sense. And then once he started to see what I was doing, he finally kind of backed off and let me exploit the programming. And that was a good show, I thought. I liked it, and it was one of my favorites. And I was happy I was given an opportunity to do that. You know, my accomplishments there, I was very thrilled that I was able to do that. I even got to meet Tomita at the time. He was happened to be in Houston at a function, and I was invited to go meet him, which I thought was nice.
And you say you're not a fan.
No. But I was not allowed to say that I was working on Dunbane.
What?
No, of course there's some weird thing like that. It's Tomino.
Yeah.
He's a weird guy.
Yeah, so I was not allowed to. I told him how much I liked it and how much I, you know, appreciated his work and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, that, you know, my career has been really all over the board, but I'm primarily a storyteller, and that's really what I do, and I try to apply my skills.
It sounds to me like, just in general, like you're sort of responsible for introducing anime to the mainstream in America in a macro sense, and that sensibility, that mainstream sensibility, and the hardcore fan culture just don't really jive. It's two different things. So when you walk into ADV and everybody in there is a flaming fanboy, they're not going to get you, you know? And they're not going to appreciate that sensibility, which is really sad, because it sounds to me like if they did try to appreciate that sensibility, maybe
we might not have had a collapse.
Maybe ADV would still be around.
do your does your data indicate which was the highest selling ADV title?
It's
Evangelion.
Yeah, Evangelion and Robotech.
Robotech.
Robotech. Oh, right. Yeah.
Much more so than Evangelion.
Right.
Yeah.
Robotech.
Robotech.
Okay, now put that into some contextual fan oriented.
Yeah.
It's a mind assault because it's like that's the anti-fan thing. And when they ultimately got their wish to dub Macross into English, what was the end result of that?
Tanks.
5 units, 6.
But you understand, you know, so somebody got their wish
to
dub Macross into English and thinking that it would to put a nail in the coffin of Robotech.
No.
But it didn't. Because people don't see the big picture.
I want to get into Lady Death because
this is
really ADV's. That's the only original animation they ever made.
No, they did Sin. Yeah.
What was Lady Death like?
Oh, that was a really unusual project. I wrote the screenplay and before I was hired as a staff member, and so I was contracted to write the screenplay. And I wrote the screenplay based on the information I was given, and it was presented to Brian Polito, who was the creator of Lady Death, and they loved it. They just went nuts. They thought it was like one of the best screenplays I'd ever read. So Dan Lefford hired me because he knew he was going to get Robotech and all this other crap, so he wanted to bring me in. Said, I'm working on it. And I was initially the producer of Lady Death. And the setup that they had, which was the same setup as they had with Sin, was what they would just hand over the project to a Japanese company, and the Japanese company would do what they were going to do. And then ADV would take the stuff and then dub it. Well, I started to look at what was being done and what they were turning out in terms of storyboards and character designs wasn't related to the movie that we had written. It was like some completely different thing. Or they had completely, the Japanese studio that they had contracted with had completely done something off the wall. So I told them that it might be better if we went and hired our own animation studio in Korea to and control the animation completely from scratch when things started to collapse. And so Andy Orwella, who was the art director at the time, and I went to Korea. We located an animation studio. We started the process. And I built an animatic with the crappy storyboards that were done from Japan. And they were just literally stick figure animatics. But I recorded the script, and I did an animatic, and I presented the animatic for timing purposes, and I did what are called exposure sheets. None of the guys here knew what I was talking about, but I built exposure sheets. I hired a guy to do timing and break down the dialogue so, you know, people could figure it out. So we had this entire package of stuff which we sent to the Koreans. And then once that happened, I was taken off the project as the producer.
Did they give you a reason?
Oh, yeah, because they thought that since I couldn't draw anything, and Andy Orwella could draw stuff, he could stay in touch with the Koreans, and he became the producer. The art director became the producer and director of the thing. And he had never directed a movie before. He'd never done anything before. So he had done this, and they took my animatic, and they gave it to the Koreans, and they made a cartoon based on the animatic that I had done. But the animatic was almost like stick figure, non-movement stuff, because I wanted to have all of the animation taking place in the layout phase, but Andy Orwella didn't know what layout phase meant, so they took the storyboards based on the crappy stuff I had cobbled together from the Japanese guys that had done it originally, and they laid that out from there, and they animated this thing, and it was almost like He-Man, where there was no animation in context of the program. There was
flapping lips. That's
yeah, it was. There was not a camera move. There was one camera movement in the entire show, and that was a tilt up. And I made better camera movement in my animatic. There's a scene where Lady Death is pushed off the Tower of Satan, falls into the River Styx, and goes along. And I actually did incredible animation in the animatic, where they're going underwater and moving. And I had done layers of this thing and After Effects. I did this incredible thing. Nothing, you know. And so I'm sitting there watching this thing go down, and that's when they made me do a Dunbine. Mm. Well, they gave me Dunbine. That was their concession. Mm. Oh, you can do Dunbine. It's something you want to do. You do Dunbine. And let Andy do ADV's animation. Well, when it was done, it was actually fairly popular because of the character and everything, but the animation itself was marginal. The cinema of the animation was crap. No offense, but it was just.
I didn't like it. It was very amateur.
You will find no fans of it here.
It was just cheese, and I'm sitting there because the script was really cool. There was one scene in the script which, had they done it correctly, would have been really cool. It's where Lady Death, before she becomes Lady Death, when she's the young girl in Sweden, she's in prison and she's talking to herself, and there's a rat, and this rat has these little red eyes. And she sees this rat, and she starts kind of spilling her guts out to this rat. And then this priest comes in and tries to manipulate her to say something that she doesn't really want to say. So the priest leaves and says, you know, you're going to die, blah, blah, blah. Well, she sees the red eyes again, and she thinks it's the rat. She starts talking to this rat again. And it turns out that these red eyes are no longer the rat, but they're actually this character called Pagan, which is this weird little dwarf that is like one of Satan's minions. But the concept of seeing these little red eyes turn into this character, cool. Cinematically cool. Completely eliminated in this concept. They had no idea. When you see it, if you read the script and you saw it was described in the script and you see how it's done there, the voice acting had no emotional arc. It was all flat. Everything was done flat. There was no drama in it. There's no action. The building of Lady Death's skills was supposed to be intercut with this building of this army, and it was you know, literally, like, there was no cinematic anything. There was a scene in there where there was supposed to be a shot where you could see the reflection of the battle in this bird's eye, where this bird then becomes from hell on earth, and nothing. You know, I mean, it's just, there's so much cinema was just glossed over because they didn't understand cinematic concepts. I was actually relegated to not even see any of the stuff as it was being done. They were so guarded with their material.
That's so backwards, and it's just like, no, let the amateurs do it. Like, we don't need your expertise.
What
a toxic environment.
Andy wasn't satisfied with the final product either, was he? I heard...
After I sent this memo that just ripped it a new hole. Basically said blah 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 blah. And then, I mean, what could he say? Oh yeah.
I guess you're right. It does suck.
I mean, obviously, I worked on two projects like that. One was this Heavy Metal Fact 2, or Heavy Metal 2000, actually, as it was called, and this Lady Death, both animated by the same animation studio in Korea. Both marginal in terms of the quality of the animation. No offense to any of the people that worked on it, but they worked based on what the directions they were given by the people that gave them the green light to go ahead and do stuff. And when you see it, and you just realize, if you would move the camera, if you would, like, you know, realize that, you know, cinema is made from shots that are counterpointed shots. Here's a guy firing arrows. Here's a guy getting an arrow in his chest. You know, whatever it is that you're going to do to show cinema.
Yeah.
Not done.
Yeah, those movies very much felt like sort of direct-to-video TV productions.
They just weren't. But the scripts were cool. I mean, if you read the scripts and you saw them, the battle between Lady Death and Satan at the end is epic. But as produced in this thing, it's weak. And, you know, so much of it is weak because it's easier to do weak than it was to think about how to creatively get something across that is cool and motivate the people that you're working with to take that extra step to do it cool. Neither product was done that way because neither group had people in place to motivate people in a way that would make sense. For whatever purposes, I get people to do work well when I'm working with them, but if I'm looking at it from the outside, I can wave at the windows. It's not much you can do. And I'm sad because my name's on it as a script writer, and the script for Lady Death isn't bad. It's just poorly acted and unrealized. The graphic intent of the thing is unrealized. The assault on Asmodeus's castle, completely wimped out. I mean, that was supposed to be cool, almost stealth-like, you know, like Enter the Dragon, where Bruce Lee's, you know, doing all that
cool stuff, or Tom Cruise and Mission Impossible. It's supposed to be, you know, a really cool thing. And it's like, you know, one drawing, a lady just floating up a, you know, come on. You know, it's like...
Yeah.
I mean, I actually reanimated one scene where they had a shot where I wanted this ghoul to get like an arrow through his chest, like a grappling hook arrow through his chest, and then have his body get pulled back. And every time they tried to tug on the thing, his body would like limp and then pull back and limp, pull back, and the blood coming out of his chest. It was a graphic scene. When they did it, they had a pool of blood there, but the colorist didn't color it with blood. It was just a guy had a green shirt on. He had a green shirt with a growing mark of black line that defined where the blood should be. So I actually took those scenes because I got them before I was taken out of the loop, and I physically recolored them in Photoshop to show them how to do that. And I retimed the whole animation of this one scene to show them how the timing should be, how I could take their shitty, you know, four drawings per second timing and turn it into like something that could look nice. But I eventually just stopped doing stuff like that.
You had to give up at some point.
Yes, I just wasn't, you know, it was unappreciated.
How did your tenure there end?
I had a 5-year contract. When the 5-year contract was up, I was offered minimum wage to continue or go.
Wow.
So Jesus. I left, and it was obvious because they could probably keep 4 or 5 people working instead of paying me. So I understood that, and I didn't have a problem with it.
Was that when there were times were getting a little tight for them?
Is that one of their first cash calls from one of their extended loans?
Near-death experiences, as we might refer to them.
I don't know, but it's just, you know, I understood it, and you know, they were blowing people off, and I didn't anticipate that they would keep me on at the level that they were paying me, but I didn't think that they would offer me minimum wage, because I knew that I couldn't support my home in Texas, and it was obvious.
Right. So now that things... Well, first of all, Ned, you moved back to L.A., obviously.
Mm-hmm.
What have you been doing since then?
Initially, I worked for Funimation for a while, writing some shows. Galaxy Railroad, I wrote some of those. And then I ended up working... I wrote a handful of... maybe a dozen Bleach episodes, and I wrote Naruto and a few other programs like that. I did some pilots for Harmony Gold. But I got to the point that I didn't really enjoy... I actually wrote Kaya Kara Mao, too. I wrote a whole bunch of those. Maybe 25 episodes of that thing. And
that couldn't have been easy.
It was difficult. It was very, very difficult. But it was interesting. It was an interesting project. But then I realized that the amount of money that I was getting paid to do that was, like, so minimal. That it was, like, why even do that? So I started, decided to go into the freelance world of writing. So I ended up being a freelance writer, and I wrote for a variety of internet startup businesses and non-entertainment-oriented things. And then just for the hell of it, one time I think I was writing a Bleach episode or something, and I got bored when I was done with it. It was a Kaya Kara Mao. I was doing that, and I just said, I had a movie in my head which I wanted to write based on a idea I had years ago for a Ray Harryhausen film. So I wrote this thing, an original movie from scratch called Girl in the Ivory Tower. So I wrote it, and then I researched who Ray Harryhausen was working with, and found their production company in Los Angeles and said, hey, I got a script for a Harryhausen project. Would you care to read it? And they said, sure, send it over. I sent it over, they read it, and said, God, this guy's great, blah, blah, blah. They hired me on the spot to work on this project called War Eagles, which was a thing that Ray Harryhausen had gotten the rights to, that was originally a Marion C. Cooper film that was going to be made in the 1940s, never got made because of the war. And it's really a great project about lost civilizations where people ride these giant birds, and then there's Nazis that are going to come and destroy New York City. And neat, pulpy 1930s romance. So they got me involved, and I wrote a screenplay for it and subsequently wrote a novel for it. And then the novel got published, and the screenplay, the company that had the screenplay, ultimately lost the rights, and then a new company got hired, and that company then rehired me to write a new screenplay for it. So I've been writing screenplays for that kind of stuff. I wrote another novel based on a character I created called The Dark, which is kind of like some horror thing set in the dawn of the Second World War. And I've been writing ghostwriting technical books and things like that. So I do a lot of different things now, trying to just survive.
Like pretty much everyone these days.
No, yeah, no. It's good that you're still out there getting his creative, you know.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, and I write a series of short stories, one a month, for a website in Canada called storyleap.com. And the guy that organized the website had an idea about this dystopian future, and he asked for somebody that could write it, and I just answered his query, and he liked what I could offer it, so I've been writing them. And they're actually really interesting stories. They're real Twilight Zone-y, kind of ironic, EC comic twisty stories, so they're kind of fun. And the goal is to try to write them in under 3,500 words. Kind of, they call them quite short stories.
Yeah, that's pretty short.
Yeah. And they're good. So that's fun to read, that kind of stuff.
So now that the market is for anime is more or less decimated, you know, as far as home video goes, where, you know, shows are struggling to reach 2,000 units, if that. And, you know, more or less, you know, Funimation's still trying their best to market stuff, but we're seeing the market, it's almost like the video game market in 1983 right now. In your opinion, what do you think we do from here? How do we get back to something that makes money, let alone...
You have to follow the proper etiquette to release material in the United States, given this context, which is, if a property is a video game property or a comic book property, you have to release the comic book, and you have to establish a demand for the ongoing properties, ancillary stuff, comic books, video games, t-shirts, whatever that is, in a very orderly manner. Otherwise, if you bypass the growth of a phenomenon or a property or a brand, you destroy any longevity that a property will have, because you don't build anything. When we were doing Streamline, I didn't take series, so I took feature films. And I established a criteria for these feature films by redistributing them in every major city in the United States. So I could have reviews from the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the blah, 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 the, you know, I had reviews. So whenever I would go to a home video store, my press packet would be outrageous. Reviews from all these, you know, nationally, you know, recognized magazines or newspapers. So, you know, you establish some weight to a thing. Now, if you have a property and it's going to be, you know, Kamen Rider 6, the purple hickey, you know, nobody knows what it is.
Just as good as, not as good as Kamen Rider 5, but better than, you know.
Nobody cares. It just, nobody cares, because there's so much of it. It's glutted. So you have to make your product stand out. How do you do that? You have to build a brand. And to build a brand, you have to do it a traditional way. It's not happening. They could build a brand by, if they wanted to do web comics and all this other stuff, but no one's trying to do that. The second way that I would consider that it would be viable is to do global distribution at the same time. So the Japanese IP holder sets a date and markets that product globally at the same time to take advantage of whatever it is that they're dealing with. So that, and with Blu-ray, you could market a global product. You could have Japanese, French, Spanish, English, German, you know, all the major food groups, covered with language on a disc. So you're manufacturing is one thing, and the master distribution is held by the IP holder, and then just farmed out. That way, it allows for a more, you know, conventional thing, less expense, you know, joint marketing funds.
Do you still pay attention to what comes out of Japan? Anything that you see these days that excites you?
I really liked Bleach when it first came out. I really did. The newer stuff, I think, is getting self-indulgent.
You don't say.
And I mean, this is just from my point of view. And I think it has to do with the fact that the people that are making that product are the second generation of fans that grew up watching the product. So it's like they're eating their own tails, the people that are doing it. There's some guys that are good. There's some guys that are marginal. There's some guys that are looking to try to get out of the rut of anime. Because I think that the anime boom not only is hitting the collapse of anime is not just the U.S. market, but I think it
world market. I think that the sale of product in Japan is not as much as it used to be. And I think a lot of it is because of this lack of focus as to what their product should be dealing with. That's just my opinion.
Right. First of all, do you have anything you'd like to plug?
No, I just, not much of anything. You know, I'd be happy to answer some questions that somebody, some of your listeners are...
We got plenty of them. I'm going to keep this pretty brief here. So we got some questions from our listeners on Twitter. Okay, so from our buddies over at AnimeWorldOrder.com, Daryl Surratt.
Is it the new Anime World Order?
That's what they call themselves. Oh, okay. They're big fans of yours.
Yeah. Well, who knows?
So, Daryl asks, what do you see as the Carl Masek legacy, if anything?
I consider myself to be more of a Johnny Appleseed personality, in which I came into the venue, planted the seeds of what I thought would be a viable way to approach the subject, and then moved on. And, you know, what grew in the fruits of that are... You know, I didn't grow the fruit. I just planted the seeds. So that's the way I see myself. And if of anything, I think that the fact that you can make successful programming if you recognize that you are localizing material for a particular audience. And I think that was a key thing that I did. I tried to localize. And I think a lot of people have not yet figured out what that means.
Animation certainly trying. Okay, so also from Daryl, we got a few from him. He said your favorite Streamline releases were Doom Megalopolis, Crying Freeman, and Wicked City. What made these your favorites?
They were adult. They were unique properties. Doom Megalopolis was a horror anime when most anime was either, you know, sexy space chicks or giant robots or things like that. Crying Freeman was, Yakuza, you know, hitmen and, you know, the triads and all the things that are atypical subject matter for anime. Not a girl's soccer team, not a, you know, people living on a spaceship, that kind of thing. And Wicked City I liked again because it was a cross-purpose thing. It was fantasy and horror combined, and I like horror and I like thrillers. I mean, I wrote a book on film noir in the early 80s, so in the late 70s actually. So I mean, I'm really into thrillers and dark things, and I like them. And I thought that the end result, I thought Doom Megalopolis was a masterpiece of animation. Just personally, I just thought it was brilliantly produced, and I thought the Wicked City was also brilliantly produced. There are certain ones that I like that no one has ever seen, which I really think are good. I like Lily Cat, which I thought was a great cartoon. And
also known as Event Horizon.
Is that what they call it?
No, Event Horizon has almost identical plot.
Oh. Yeah. From Severance, which is Gerald from Anime World Order, do you enjoy the moniker of Uncle Carl, as I'm told this is what you were called during the dubbing of Dunbeat?
Not really.
Okay. Note to people, don't call him that.
I mean, I don't really care one way or the other. It was not meant to be derogatory.
Right.
It was meant to be, I guess, respectful. But because ultimately the people at ADV began to realize who I was. And right. No one knew who I was when I first came there.
Really?
No. I mean, the hardcore guy, they even made me make a fake name for the first thing I did, which was AD Police. I was called Frank Carlson.
Well, that was such a terrible show. Maybe that was for the best.
Well, whether it was or wasn't. But, I mean, you know, but no one there really knew who I was because they didn't really care because they had their own subculture there.
Wow.
So as they began to realize who I was and what I had done and I started to talk to them, they started to go, oh, they started to get it. And so they just became Uncle Carl because I was much older than everybody else there, too.
This is actually a fairly relevant question based on your comments about ADV. From ABCB Tom, who's better at driving a company into the ground? Anime fans who don't know business or business degrees who don't know anime?
Boy.
A little loaded, but...
I think that both groups can share equally in the demise because of... One takes into account the fact that because they love it, everybody should love it.
And the other group takes into account the fact that how can I do this cheaper and, you know, get adequate results. So my theory had always been take as long as necessary to get something done and do it right. For example, I did a thing called Barefoot Gen. And when we got that show, they didn't have any sound effects for it. They didn't have any separate anything. So I had to take just like raw music cues and I had to recreate music for it. I had to recreate sound effects and I had to do an elaborate production. I mean, it took a very long time. And for Streamline, it was all my own money. And I spent enormous amounts of time doing that particular show because I wanted to get it right because it was a fairly dramatic and fairly important project.
And it's a hard show to watch.
It's a hard show. It was a hard show to produce.
Yeah.
And, you know, nobody would have taken the time to do that properly. I mean, it didn't make any sense whatsoever to anybody, you know, but I did it because I felt compelled to do it. And that's the difference between being an artist trying to do it or being a fan trying to do it. It's not that I'm an artist, you know, with a, you know, halo around my head, but I consider myself to have artistic point of view, and I tried to exploit whatever talent I did have in ways that would make sense. And, you know, if you're a fan, you don't see it because you're so close to it. And if you're a businessman, you don't see it because you're so close to the business. You don't get the art.
So it's sort of just a weird middle ground that has to be found somewhere.
You have to understand, if you're going to do something, what is it going to cost to acquire it? When the cost of acquisition is more than the cost of production, and you have to produce quickly in order to expend to have the shortest amount of exposure to your outlay of capital, you make decisions that are not for the best interest of the product. For us, when Streamline was doing stuff, we didn't spend a fortune to acquire, but we spent a considerable amount of time developing and producing these things so that they could be evergreen. And no one produces evergreen anymore. Everyone produces for quick and get it out. And they don't get it. They don't understand you can go back and you can finesse things. If you don't like it, do it over again. At ADV, for example, none of the directors ever sat in the mix. They never sat in the mix. I couldn't believe it. I was the only director that sat in the mix. And they didn't understand why I sat there. And I said, because if you make Joe sound louder than Bill, and Bill's closer to the screen than Joe, it doesn't make sense because it doesn't hit the right level of believability. And I had to teach these people how to mix products so that it sounded natural in a natural environment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All the directors at ADV would do is they would sit there and they would go on to something else, and then they'd get a video and they'd listen to it and they'd make notes. Oh, you know, and they would miss so many things. But if you sat there and you're in the room with the mixer, you could say, raise that machine gun a little bit louder, make the music you come in a little bit smoother here, and do this, do that.
It's almost like the object lesson here is, it's great to be a passionate fan. It's a wonderful thing to have passion for something and be really into it. But really, really liking cartoons does not necessarily qualify you to be a sound engineer. And there is a technical education you have to learn before you go into this.
A lot of those guys, they would graduate from school and they had some knowledge of how to use Pro Tools, and that was it. If you could operate Pro Tools, that was it. And one of the things they did at ADV, which I thought was really weird, is that they cut out every natural glottal sound that someone would make. When you talk, there are clicks and little things in your throat. Well, one of the key things that they wanted to do at ADB was get rid of every one of those lip smacks and sounds. So it was like just the most pristine recording of something, so you don't hear any of the... You can hear my... You hear that? There's nothing in ADB. To me, that's a waste because it becomes unnatural.
Yeah.
Right.
But, you know, it's an exercise in having somebody do something. I mean, you can do it in a way that you can have gates and you can have things that can get out the large things,
right.
But not every aspect of that. And I think that those concentration on things like that gets away from the aesthetic of what it is you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. Try to produce as good a product as possible.
Okay, briefly, from Playback Jason, how successful was Fist of the North Star compared to other Streamline releases? The TV series and manga never seemed to find a large audience here, large enough to stick around.
The theatrical was very successful, and the video, home video, was very successful. when you have a television series like Visit the North Star, impossible to get it exploited on television correctly because of the nature of the violence and the whole nature of
the can't have a kids show with exploding heads.
You could, but you couldn't market it properly right. at the time. You could maybe market it now on maybe some, you know, guy channel or something that they have. But it's hard to get those shows marketed properly because there is no venue for it. That's why we never went for the series. It was too many episodes, and the acquisition rights are huge. When there's, I don't know how many episodes, 147, 150, huge number of episodes. The acquisition rights are so high that in order to get them and then produce them, it's millions of dollars, and it's an impossible hill to climb. The comics, on the other hand, are also so they're primitive, and they were marketed in black and white. And I think that's one of the reasons. I don't know if they've ever done a color version of them, but they were early on. But cool, they're cool comics, but hard to see in the way that I have seen them in the past. So I don't know if they've done a redo of those comics.
There was a color spinoff, but none of it's ever been successful. Honestly, I think it's the art style. Anime fans don't really get into that art style very much. At least on a large scale, anime fans.
Yeah. But an interesting property, nevertheless. And the movie was very successful.
It's a classic. From Zaruda, I'm going to assume you know what he's talking about, but if you don't, that's fine. Why did you excise that CG skull thing from Golgo 13, The Professional?
I think it had to do with something that was in the opening credits. And the Japanese at the time, when I requested a neutral opening, which would be a opening footage without Japanese text over it, didn't have it. So in order to release the product, I didn't feel that it was smart to release product with Japanese kanji over it and then subtitle below. That to me was just like a wrong thing, because we were not trying to promote that as a foreign language film. We were trying to promote it as a Western marketed product. So I wanted to eliminate those particular sequences, and that's why, because we could not get a neutral open and closing from the original producers. Had there been a neutral opening, we would have kept it intact.
Okay.
To wrap up, I'd love to just... There's a couple... I'm looking at your anime-related filmography here. There's just a couple weird ones I just want to... I'd love to ask you about, if that's okay. I have to ask about Megazone 2-3 Part 2, the international version.
Oh. that was a weird project where InterSound was hired to produce an English-language version of Megazone 2-3 Part 2 as a teaching tool to teach English to Japanese-speaking people. So it was not something that I did, per se. It was done at InterSound. And it was written by a guy named Tom Weiner. Tom Weiner had written some of the Robotech episodes and some other programs, and he was a very flamboyant, kind of Shakespearean, larger-than-life guy, and was always like pontificating. And so he took over he wanted to turn this into his Robotech, his thing. He wanted to do this thing. And so I was actually on the sidelines. And at the time that this was being done, I think in the international version, I'm not sure, but I think they took the animation that I had produced for Robotech the movie, and they threw that on either the beginning of that or
right.
at some point. And I thought that was kind of a weird thing that they didn't really have the rights to do at the time, but no one other than me knew about it or recognized what it was or cared. So
I have to ask about the Robotech movie. I think most people know the story by now, but if you could just go walk us through what
basically we were producing Robotech at the time, and Disney was releasing a film called The Black Cauldron, and this news reporter in L.A. named Sam Chu Lin thought, I think maybe one of his neighbors or one of his kids or somebody really liked Robotech. And he made the speculation that could Japanese animation programming like Robotech replace Disney when Disney was now making films like The Black Cauldron, which is a darker, non-traditional Disney type film. And was The Black Cauldron influenced by this kind of stuff? And this, that, and the other. So they came to InterSound and they interviewed us recording Robotech. And that night after it was broadcast, Frank Agrama, the owner of Harmony Gold, got a call from the people that own Canon Films. It was either Yoram Globus or Menachem Golan. One of those two guys called them up and said, hey, we want to put out a movie of Robotech. So I could call them to the office the next day. Is there a Robotech movie that we can do? And I said, yeah, there's a great one. It's called Do You Remember Love? That's the great animation. You know, that would be like the great jewel of animation to put out in theaters. Well, they tried to get that, the rights to that, and they couldn't get it for whatever reason. I don't know. Whatever political reasons, they couldn't get it. So they came back to me and said, is there anything else that looks similar that you could deal with? And I said, well, there's this movie here, Megazone 23.1, which I think kind of looks like Robotech, because it's designed by the same guy that did some of the character designs in Macross. And so they acquired that, and then they gave it to us to manipulate into Robotech the movie. And so I did that, and I wanted to have it end. I wanted it to be what takes place on Earth while the SDF-3 was in outer space. And so we were going to billboard it, or we were going to kind of put it between the SDF-3 going into outer space and the SDF-3 coming back and landing at the end of episode 13. This was like what was going on Earth. And so we started to do this process, and then I went to Japan to do the Sentinels. And while I was in Japan, the people at Canon wanted to see a preliminary work on what was done, and so they showed them what was done, and they didn't like it because there was too many girls in it and there wasn't a lot of action, because it was what it was. So I got called back from Japan while we were doing Sentinels, and I was asked to retool Robotech the movie. And I said, how do you do that? And they said, well, you're a genius, you go do it. So I sat around and I thought about it, and so I came up with the story, and I edited all this footage from the Southern Cross section into Megazone 23 Part 1 and turned it into Robotech the movie. And then I went and brought what I had done to the Canon people, and I remember doing a John Chris Belushi in this theater. I was in this room, and I just acted out the whole show, jumping around on tables and doing explosions and making stuff go like boom, blah, blah, blah. And I did this for about 25 minutes, and I told them the whole story of it. And when it was done, the lights come up, and I go, now you've got a Canon movie. And they were like happy. They were thrilled. So we did this. We reproduced this movie. And I wanted to have an ending, so we hired the guy that was the storyboard guy from Mad Max to animate or storyboard the ending of the film.
And lest anyone think the Canon guys were like these harbingers of great cinema, they were flush with money from Break-In and Break-In 2 Electric Boogaloo at this
and
point.
The Runaway Train. And
right.
And other films like that. So, and the Richard Chamberlain, Quartermass, or whatever, not Quartermass, but the King Solomon's Mine and all those movies they were doing. Alan Quatermain movies. So anyway, we make this movie, and the theory was that it was a kid's movie, because they never thought beyond the fact that animation was a kid's movie, and they were going to market it as a kid's movie. And I was sent to go to Texas to help in the grassroots promotional marketing of the film, because I had done that before for Star Wars and other films. So when we went there, we were very successful. We got the film positioned, and it did exceptionally well with the box office, and it actually beat it opened on the same week, a weekend or so later than Aliens, James Cameron's Aliens. So I have a photograph of myself standing in front of a marquee where it has Aliens and Robotech the movie on a marquee as a classic to see the thing. And then there's a couple other movies, Pirates, Roman Polanski's Pirates, opened the same weekend, and that was a Canon film as well. Robotech the movie beat the hell out of Pirates and did respectable against James Cameron's Aliens, which was amazing to me. It did really well. But it played in about 35 theaters in about a 75-mile radius, Dallas, Fort Worth, and surrounding venues. When they got the demographics back, they realized it was poised to open in 1,400 theaters about a month later. When they got the demographics back, they realized that 95% of the audience or more was adult. And they were going to target, they had bought time, or they had committed to buy time on every major TV kids program, the Smurfs, He-Man. They were going to market this thing to children. And the report was that children couldn't stand this movie because it was like loud explosions, since kids are crying. It wasn't a cartoon for kids.
No, that's a violent anime.
Incredibly violent thing. And so they freaked out. And they got cold feet, and they withdrew the film from distribution so they could figure out how to retool it and remarket the film. And then the bottom fell out of the Canon venue. The marketing guys left, and it just got to be, like, really messy. And it, one of those situations where the product fell through the cracks and ended up not being released in the United States. It was released overseas.
So. But I got a copy of that version. That's actually way different than the internet version, so I'm glad I asked that.
Oh, what's the internet version?
Internet version was that it was pulled because no one liked it.
Oh, no. No. It was
I didn't think it was that. It was different from Robotech as far as regular Robotech as far as the tone of it.
The tone was very similar. What I enjoyed about doing it is that I learned how to produce a movie in Dolby Stereo for theatrical exploitation, and it was done on primitive machinery that you'll never get a chance to use again. We used, do you know what a 35 millimeter dubber is?
Is that the one that goes from the optical printer, basically?
No. What a dubber is, the 35 millimeter dubber is a giant tape recorder that is reel to reel 35 millimeter film that has a magnetic stripe on it, and you put sound effects on it. But this is before they had, like, digital.
Oh, right, and you have like eight or nine tracks of those all.
Right. Well, we mixed this at the Walt Disney Studios, believe it or not.
Oh, the irony.
In the Disney Theater on the lot. And we had the people that mixed out of Africa as our mixing team. There were three guys. Audio guy for voice, audio guy for sound effects, audio guy for music. And then my own audio guy was there. And so we mixed this film in this huge thing in Dolby Surround Sound. It was really an amazing process. But we used every dubber that they had there, which was about 45 dubbers. And they couldn't believe it because they had to wire this thing into the soundboard because there'd be a thing where there might be just like one pop on one 10-minute reel of film. It was a mess to put this thing together. And then I also had this guy, George Boers, there, who's the audio mixer. George Boers had an Emulator 2 state-of-the-art big thing keyboard with like a floppy disk thing. And he brought like a host of sound effects just in case I saw something on the big screen that was missing that I wanted to add. And so we were doing this, and the guys from out of Africa, they had just done Toby Hooper's Invaders from Mars as a team, and they thought, oh, we got a cartoon, that'll be easy. they were like going crazy because we were mixing this thing in a really spectacular way, and the mixing is really cool. If you actually watch it in Dolby Stereo, it's unbelievable. But George Boers had the ability to sit there and watch something, and if I wanted him to punch in and do something, he could punch in a sound effect for, if I missed an explosion on the left side of the screen where it was like something hits a wall and debris collapses, and these guys couldn't believe that George could hit it live because they were so concerned about the mix. I said, let us do it one time. If we screw up one time, we're bad, we won't do it again. If we do it right, then trust us. And so George, the pressure was on George to get this one thing because there was a scene where this like part of a building falls down, and he just casually hits it right at the exact proper time, goes into the mix, everybody's happy, and they go, oh, shit, I never thought that we could do that. So we taught these guys that you can actually do cool stuff with crappy equipment.
Okay. Space Pirate Captain Harlock.
Oh, that was a funny one. We were successful in distributing, Harmony Gold was successful in distributing Robotech, but it was distributed not through Harmony Gold's distribution machine, but it was distributed through a company that was that understood how to market for kids television.
Right.
So it's kind of hard to describe it or explain.
A TV syndicate, basically.
But it wasn't a syndicate. It was mostly, here's a guy that has ads that he can dole out from toy companies or Coca-Cola company, blah blah blah. And here I've got product. So he'll say, if I want to get my show on your channel, I can give you 25 commercials, right?
Sort of a matchmaker.
Yeah. So anyway, that's how Robotech got put on, because in a quick period of time, we got this guy that had all this. He was a media buyer, and he had all this product that he could sell, and he had a show that he could attach it to. And it just perfect storm again of coincidence. Well, the syndication guy at Harmony Gold was frustrated because he didn't get a chance to sell that. So he approached me one time in the hallway and asked if there was anything else that was good. the animation was good. I said, oh, yeah, I like Captain Harlock. I think that's a great show. He goes, oh, okay, good. Walks away. But 3 months later, he comes up and he says, hey, we sold Captain Harlock to, 45 channels already, and we're going strong. And I said, when are you going to start? I said, what? News to me. He said, what did you sell? 65 half hours. I said, well, there's only like 42 Captain Harlocks. I don't think there's... And, there was, maybe there were 45. I don't remember. I said, there's not 65.
No.
And so he goes, well, what are we going to do? I said, I don't know. So they called me into the office and they said, well, what are we going to do? I said, well, why don't you get like SSX or something like that? It's another Captain Harlock show, and we'll just put a tag it on to the end. And he said, okay. Well, they tried to get that. They couldn't get it. So they said, well, okay, what else did the guy that did Captain Harlock do that we can get? Well, the only thing that was available was the Queen of a Thousand Years, Queen Millennium. And I said, well, we can maybe combine those two shows together in some weird way.
They look similar.
Yeah.
They're both Leiji Matsumoto.
Yeah, right. So they got those, and they allowed me the opportunity to do that. So I said, okay. Not that I really wanted to do that, but it wasn't my, brainchild. So what's funny is that fans believe that I'm like some Machiavellian guy sitting in a room somewhere thinking, how can I screw a fan? Let me figure out how I can like combine Captain Harlock and the Queen of a Thousand Years into a show. No, this is a necessity that was invented by a circumstance. So anyway, I figured a way to put these two shows together and blend them. And again, I was using this cool system that this guy had invented with this rheostat to speed up and slow down the thing. So and I would just do this. And I created the show almost like stream of consciousness. I would take one episode, one of Captain Harlock, episode one of Queen of a Thousand Years, and I would just, whenever I got bored or whenever it didn't work, I would just stop, and I would start Queen of a Thousand Years, and I would just, whenever that didn't work, I would just keep going mosaically putting them together in a storytelling thing. And then, while I was doing it, I had a little laptop computer, and I would write the story that I wanted to have these guys sell. So I was writing the story and composing this thing at night, and then they were going to record it like 3 or 4 days later, so they had to write a script really fast.
Oh, my God.
It was like this, almost like a live thing. And I figured, who cares? And so I left all sorts of stuff in there, like completely nude women. like the May Zone. They're green, but they're totally nude. I left them in. So there's sequences where there's totally nude women running around killing people. And there was a scene in there where there's a live childbirth. So I said, screw it, leave it in. So there's a live... So here's a cartoon that has nude women, live childbirth. Nobody, I guarantee you, very few fans have seen the entire show, for one thing.
Right.
If any, no one has ever commented about these aspects of this show. And beyond that, it was actually a good science fiction show. It was really good. The people that did it really enjoyed working on it. The actors loved it. I mean, the show itself, and it's not one of those Emperor's New Clothes kind of a deal. Where,
yeah, it's Leiji Matsumoto. It's good stuff.
It's fabulously plotted, and it's cool. I mean, it was a really good adventure, science fiction adventure. High-end science fiction for TV. Where is it? I don't know. Does anyone have copies of it? I don't know. There might be a copy, two or three copies floating around, but seen in context, it's a really cool show because it works. It intertwines and does its thing. I don't know how much of it you've ever seen.
But I've seen like one episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same here.
Yeah.
I actually have one sample in my collection of VHSs. I have the Origin of Captain Harlock episode. I think it was like episode 45 or something like that. But towards the end, I mean, there are scenes in there where the May Zone are just attacking the spaceship, and there's like 500 naked green women running down a hallway, and they're being machine gunned by this guy. And okie dokie.
Surely the affiliates must have.
Nobody has ever, to this day, said a word about the show. Some people said, "Oh, we loved it," that have seen it, but I just wait for them to say, "But how did you get that across? How did you get that past it?" Nobody.
That's
not a single person has said anything. And I enjoyed working on that thing. But again, that's the kind of crap that got my reputation as being like this Frankenstein anime guy that you would just enjoy. And I didn't enjoy. I didn't want to do it. And then I stopped working at Harmony Gold. And as you can see, the stuff from Streamline was actually pretty much intact.
Right.
One thing that I did notice, one guy asked a question and he said, did I like to do stuff that was more character faithful as opposed to word faithful in terms of the scripts. And I think that, yes, the answer is I'm more interested in the storytelling, not in the specific words
right.
that the guys say, because that to me is key to the...
It's the arc, reinforcing the arc.
Yeah.
Windaria.
Oh, that one's another one where was originally called Windaria, but I think it was ended up being called Once Upon a Time. And that one was an interesting project. I particularly liked the thing, but we weren't really given any scripts. We had no idea what the story was when we got the chance to do this. We couldn't get a translation of it to actually produce, and we had a time frame that had to be done by a certain amount of time.
So you just had to kind of wing it.
Yeah. And I liked that show, too. And I actually got the guy that was the professor from Gilligan's Island to be the voice of the narrator of the show.
Oh.
Russell Johnson.
And last one, because this caught my eye, because I didn't know you had anything to do with this, Rogen Z.
Oh, yeah. I was the original, I was contracted to be the original, I was one of the original producers of the film, and my side of the job was to produce the sound effects. So I did the entire sound effects bed for the film.
For the Japanese?
Yeah, for the Japanese.
Oh, wow.
And I worked on it here. And created a sound effects, but it was hilarious because I did a. It was produced for Sony Music. They were the entity,
right?
And it was produced under APPP Company, who's a friend of mine, Kazufumi Nakamura.
They did Robot Carnival.
Yeah, they did Robot Carnival. Friends of mine, so they hired me because they liked what I did on the other things. And so when I asked them how they wanted it to be delivered, they said 16-track Fostex, which is this primitive system.
Yeah, that's like old analog reel-to-reel with
yeah.
no sync, right?
Yeah. I said, that's what you want? Yeah, that's what we want. And I said, okay, so, and I said, so what am I going to get? What material am I going to get? Oh, storyboard. So they gave me not even layouts, but like just storyboard. And they sent one of the supervising storyboard lead artists come down and tell me what was going on in the interior of the scene. So I could like do Foley and stuff like that. I mean, how am I going to do Foley if you can't see the guy walking step by step by step by step? So we produced this very detailed 16-track Fostex. And I did it in such a way that since it wasn't a Fostex, everything could be slid. You know,
right.
You can slide it. So, but I was happy with the results. 16 tracks. It was a lot of work. And I mean, I created sound effects, especially at the end when the thing was... if you've seen the movie, there's a scene where they're in this like junk pile, everything's like falling down.
Right.
And so, I mean, I made incredible sound effects in that particular thing for, you know, getting little pebbles to hit, and it was a real crazy, 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 crazy thing. So when it was all done, I gave it to the guy to go back to Japan, and he falls asleep in the airport and misses his plane, so he doesn't take it to Japan with him. He falls asleep and misses his plane flight because he was like exhausted from working. So I get a call.
The guy's not on the plane.
You know, they're waiting for him to come and he's not there. So I go back, run to the airport. The guy's like sleeping in the airport. So I had to buy a ticket and fly to Japan. and I take the tracks. So he and I go to Japan. I give the track to the guy early, late at night when we get in, instead of being early in the morning. We get in late at night and I tell the guy, okay, here's your 16 tracks. Mix them down to 2-track stereo. And then we'll go to the mixing the next morning. So I go to bed. I get up in the morning. They take me down to the studio. And I'm sitting in the studio. And everyone's there. It's a Japanese guy. And I'm just sitting there and introduced all the way around. And how the hell are you? And they start like rolling this film. And whenever you do a music track like this, in order to know what there is so that you can slide it, I had done a music cue sheets. But for the sound effects. So they were literally like sheet music for every reel of film.
It had to be a book.
It was like a book. And it showed on every reel of film at 10 feet, 4 frames, there's a footfall on track 8. At 10 feet, you know, it literally was like detailed to that level. So, and we had this huge book. And I'm following along, and I'm not hearing the footfalls. I'm not hearing this or whatever. I'm not hearing the alarm clock or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going like, man, what's going on here? And they're just ignoring me, and they're just going on and on and on and on. And they go to the first reel, and they stop, and I go, wow. And the guy says, start over again. I said, oh, good. They're going to start over again. So they start over again. They're going over again because they didn't like what they had done. They start over again. They're doing it again. And there's no ticking clocks. There's no foot pauses. And I finally pulled one of the guys. I said, what happened to these tracks? I said, look here. There's supposed to be a ticking. And they said, oh, you set the mix down to two tracks. I said, yeah, well, we picked two tracks. I said, so you just picked two tracks out of the 16? Yeah, we picked the ones with the most sound.
Oh, God.
And so I said, okay. And so then I watched them produce this thing. And what they did, which was really bizarre, was they wouldn't stop. If they made a mistake, they'd just keep going till the end and turn around and start over again until they got it to their satisfaction with the least amount of problems. And then they'd go on to the next reel. And I said, do you guys know how to punch in? I said, what? Punch in. If you don't like something, you stop. You roll the tape back a little bit. You start over again. And at the part where you want to, where there's a spot to punch in, where there's no audio that you were going to click, you punch in. And then you pick up from there. You just find a spot and you punch in. Oh, we don't know. So they didn't understand how to. This is Sony. They didn't understand how to do this kind of thing. And so I said, okay. And they were under the gun to try to get this thing mixed so that they could do a presentation at a screening that night or the next day with Otomo and the Odonari or whatever his name is, the guy that was the character designer and blah, blah, blah. So they did that. And it was shown, and you know, everybody was happy and applauding. How are you? And then I left. And then I think they went back and they realized what they had done, and they went back and they took all the 16 tracks and, you know, put the sound effects.
Flatten
them. Yeah, put it back in. But it was like, I said, oh my God, that, you know, it got to be so funky like that. But it was an interesting experience.
And this is why sound effects and anime never match.
Well, it's because, that's why, and it's proof incarnate that anime is not infallible. I mean, there are fans that think that the anime filmmakers walk on water and they do nothing wrong. And whatever I did in Streamline, and I added an extra sound effect, or I diminished one, or I changed that line of dialogue, I'm like destroying a sacrosanct situation for people because I've changed it. Somebody wanted to know why I changed the sequence of Robot Carnival episodes. Well, the reason that was changed was because when you distribute a movie, it's on 2,000-foot reels. And if I would have kept it in the same order that it was, there would have been 7 reels as opposed to 6 reels. If I moved one from here to there so I could equalize the number of reels, I could put it in 6 reels, which meant I only had to send out 3 cases, or 2 cases with 3 reels each in them, as opposed to 3 cases. Or, you know, and so it was a shipping decision, and I told Kazafumi Nomura, I can do this or I can do that. It'll cost me less to do this, and you can get more money because there'll be less distribution costs. And he said, it doesn't make any difference to me because they just were put that way because that's how they were put. There was no intellectualization as to why they were put in a particular way. So why the fans want to know why this was changed from this order to that order? That's why. And it had nothing to do with anybody wanting it a particular way. It just was done. And people complain about the present script. The present script was written by this guy, Tom Weiner, who's the guy that wrote the Megazone 2-3 Part 2 international version.
That explains all the film school dialogue.
So, and it's not me. And if people say, me. No. I got the dialogue. I assumed that it was an accurate translation to the thing. I didn't have the time to, because I was running Streamline, I didn't have the time to read it to see and make changes. You know, at a certain point, you have to trust the people that you hire to do these things, and I did it, and it seemed to be okay, but it was him trying to be articulate in a way that was irrational to my way of thinking.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah. I hate to leave it there, but
thank you so much, and that's it for this week.
Yep.